All right, so, okay, so we're now going to talk about, we're going to switch from conformal symmetry to dual conformal symmetry. And the kinematics here has actually nothing to do with n equals 4 super Yang mills, nothing to do with, it just has to do with something beautiful that happens when you have a cyclic, when you have a natural cyclic ordering for the n particles, 1, 1, 1 through n. And what we're going to do is introduce these beautiful variables that, well, I mean, once you think twistorially, it's completely obvious that you should do this. But they're very beautiful variables, which are the sort of complete the little project of describing the external data in a totally unconstrained way, right? So we began with going with p's, the lambdas and lambda tildes, right? So now we don't have to put any constraints on the p, these quadratic constraints. If we just give lambda and lambda tilde, p is automatically on shell. But we have to put some funny quadratic constraint on it still. The sum of the lambda, lambda tildes has got to vanish. Just imagine trying to do it on a computer, right? I mean, people who do these things professionally have to do it on a computer. The question is, how do you just generate a bunch of points, a bunch of momenta that are null that satisfy momentum conservation, right? Just that. So, good, you put lambdas and lambda tildes, that's good. That's going to guarantee they're all null. But then you've got to put some damn quadratic constraint at the end that momentum is conserved. Okay? So what we're going to see is just a bunch of beautiful variables. You specify totally unconstrained variables, and it'll generate for you momenta that are null and conserve momentum. On top of everything, but on top of that, of course, the action of the dual conformal symmetry is going to be beautiful on them. The amplitudes will look incredibly beautiful written to these variables. And as I said, they've played a very important role in the development of the subject over the past couple of years. Okay, so but let me just remind you of the space that we're talking about that Johannes drew. So imagine that we have n particles, but they're naturally ordered for some reason. For Yang-Mills amplitudes, it's because they're in a color ordering, and we're interested in planar amplitudes. Okay. But for this purpose, they're just ordered. And so we're going to just draw the momenta end to end. If we draw the momenta end to end, they make this closed polygon. Momentum conservation means that they make this closed polygon. Okay? So sum of pi equals 0 is guaranteed. Another way of saying this is that we can label the vertices by x's. So this is some x space, and we're saying that PA mu is xA plus 1 mu minus xA mu. Okay? And if we do that, we're guaranteed that momentum is conserved. If we define P in that way, then momentum conservation is made trivial. Okay? Now notice immediately that these x's are not going to be unique. Of course, I can translate everything. So I've removed the constraint at the expense of introducing a redundancy. Okay, I can translate the x's and have the same p's. That's going to be, we'll come back to that in a second. That translational symmetry here, when we start talking about Yang-Mills amplitudes, is actually part of the whole dual conformal symmetry. It's the translation part of the dual conformal symmetry. The translations act utterly trivially. They're just a redundancy. But the rest of it is most certainly not a redundancy and has highly non-trivial content. Okay? All right, but okay, but this is still not all that useful, right? Because I have to give these x's, but then I have to put as a constraint that the x's are null separated from each other. So we can make momentum conservation trivial like this. We can make the fact that p's are null trivial by writing them as lambda, lambda, tilde, but we still haven't succeeded in making them both trivial at the same time. Okay? So what we'd like to do is to make them both trivial at the same time. Now, let's come back to just talking about the amplitudes for a second. Well, let's forget about the amplitudes. Just this picture, because these segments are null, whether you like it or not, whatever the heck the theory is, because the segments are null, this polygon transforms nicely under conformal transformations. Under conformal transformations in this X space, These are not our usual conformal transformations, but conformal transformations in this funny X space take null edges into null edges. And so, just again, totally ignoring dynamics, just the kinematics of ordered points, cyclically ordered points, null cyclically ordered points, has a conformal symmetry. Okay? Has a nice conformal symmetry. Of course, in n equals 4 superangulars, that conformal symmetry is a symmetry of the amplitudes. Okay? So that's it's not a trivial kinematic symmetry, it's an actually symmetry of the amplitudes. All right, but let's follow what we were just talking about before and try to describe and introduce twister variables to talk about this conformal symmetry. So there's this conformal symmetry acting on X variables, these X variables. So let's introduce twister variables. Well, so what do? We know exactly what we should do. Associated with each one of these points X here, so the way I wrote it, so P2 is X3 minus X2, so that's X3, so I wrote it properly. So that's X3, that's X2, and so on. So that's a picture in this X spacetime, in this dual spacetime. So what is the picture in its corresponding twister space? So this is called momentum twister space. The momentum, to remind you, that is associated with these momentum polygon. Well, X1 is a line in twister space. So that's the line corresponding to X1. X2 is another line in twister space. But X1 and X2 are null separated from each other. So that means that the line that corresponds to X1, so here's a line that corresponds to X1, there's a line that corresponds to X2, they must intersect each other because those guys are null separated, right? So here's a line that corresponds to X2. There's a line that corresponds to X3, X4, X5. So associated with the polygon in spacetime is a picture of lines, one intersecting the next in twister space. Is that clear? Now, I can completely specify what that picture is in twister space by giving the intersection points. Let me call that point, that was a line X1. I don't know, let me call this point Z1. Let me call it Z2. Z3. Z4, it doesn't matter. Okay, and Z1 here. Okay. So said another way, if I just hand you arbitrary twister variables, arbitrary z's, z1, z2, z3, totally unconstrained, right? Then, starting from that picture, I draw these lines. Right? And now, I take each one of those, each line is a point in space-time. The next one is another point in space-time, guaranteed to be null separated from each other, and forming a polygon. Okay. So these are totally unconstrained variables that if you hand them to me, I build from them a bunch of momenta that are each null and whose sum to zero. Okay. Now we can actually write down an explicit formula. So in other words, so XA, let's say, I'm going to associate with a line ZA, ZA minus 1, say. Okay? The point XA, I'll associate with the line ZA, ZA minus 1. So you can use the formula that we wrote down a little while ago that says what the coordinate for X is in terms of these guys, right? So like XA alpha alpha dot would be mu A alpha lambda A minus 1 alpha dot minus mu A minus 1 alpha minus mu A minus 1 alpha dot lambda A alpha over lambda A minus 1 lambda A. So we gave that formula for the point associated with a given line. So that's an explicit formula for the X's. Now from here, you can get an explicit formula for the lambdas and lambda tildes. So PA equals xA plus 1 minus xA. Okay? And so you take that formula, you find what the PA is, and you can read off from that the lambda and the lambda tilde. The lambda, unsurprisingly, is the same as the lambda. So what we find is the following formula. So lambda is lambda, and lambda tilde is the following pretty expression. A minus 1A mu A plus 1. Plus a plus 1, a minus 1, mu a. So just cyclically ordered. Plus a plus 1, mu a minus 1, over a minus 1, a plus 1. Okay. So very explicitly then, if I hand you a mu a and a lambda a, if I hand you some zas, from here, I can get an associated lambda a and lambda tilde a that can serve as momentum. Okay?
How much is that?
It's four-dimensional. Each one of these are two, so each one of these z's are four-dimensional, but remember, it's projective, so it's up to overall rescaling. Okay, so I can rescale them all. And so each one is a point in CP3. Okay? Yes. Well, so it's a 4n dimensional space naively, okay? Because I can take out of those 4n dimensional variables, I can take out n of them by rescaling each one, so that's 3n. But you have to remember there's a conformal symmetry, so I can use conformal symmetry to take out 15, which is the dimensionality of SL4, okay? So in the end, the total number of independent variables is 3 times n minus 5. Which is actually the right number of, you know, is the correct number of variables. Okay? Yes? Huh? Yes, everything is complex. Yes, everything is complex. The reality condition is a quadratic condition on these guys. Okay, so it depends on what you mean by nice. You can write down formulas, but if I hand you, yeah, maybe I'll take. Let me just take 2 minutes to talk about this. Sorry. So, yeah. Let me say a couple of more things about this, and I'll come to Michael's question, because I really should have said that in my general twistorial discussion, even though, right. So, okay. So first of all, notice again that we had a redundancy here, right? We had a redundancy of translations. I can just translate things. But that redundancy is just part of the whole conformal. That redundancy is just part of the whole SL4 that acts on the momentum twister variables, first of all. Okay. So these are indeed unconstrained variables, but they're redundant. They're unconstrained redundant variables. But the good thing is that the redundancy is part of the symmetry that the amplitudes actually have. So that's wonderful. That makes it, we don't have to, and it's very easy to keep track of it. In fact, the translations and everything else gets elevated to the statement that things should be built only out of SL4 invariants that are made out of these guys. Okay. All right. Now, if we come to the question, now let's come to the question of reality. And this has nothing to do. This is just a general property of any correspondence between twister space and Minkowski space. I told you that what these twister variables are doing are they're giving you complex null lines. Okay. Well, and we've made a correspondence between complex null lines and points in CP3 when everything is complex. So that's 6 real dimensional, right? Now, the space of real lines in Minkowski space is 5 dimensional. Okay. Real null lines in Minkowski space is pick an origin. So first of all, move out from that, take your laser beam and move it out from the origin someplace. So that's 3 three variables and then point it in some direction. That's two angular variables. So the space of null, real null lines in Minkowski space is five real dimensional. A naive complexification directly of the space of null lines would give you a 10 real dimensional space. Twister space is not a naive complexification of the space of null lines. Okay? It's a very special one, which is six dimensional. Okay? Gives you a correspondence between complex lines, which are, it's a six dimensional space. So, so this is extremely nice because the space of null lines, the real null lines, is a codimension one thing inside this six dimensional space. So the picture is that you have CP3, which is a six dimensional space, and inside this six dimensional space is a five dimensional thing that cuts it in half. So think of it, now it's not flat, it's a curved thing. Okay, we'll see precisely what I mean by that in a second, but it cuts it in half. And so this is called, it's called PN. And in fact, so it's really chopped CP3 into two halves, so that the top plus is called PT plus, and the bottom part is called PT minus. Okay. Now, what characterizes this five-dimensional space? Well, the complex conformal group is SL4. But that's not the actual conformal group of that's not the actual real conformal group. Okay? The real conformal group is SU2, 2. So there is really a real form which is not invariant under SL4, but is invariant under SU2, 2. Just stick something with two pluses and two minuses. Right? That matrix is not invariant under general SL4 transformations, but is invariant under the SU2, 2 subgroup. Okay? So the points in PN are characterized by the condition that if you take, so, that z bar z is equal to 0. So if z is a mu lambda, then the z bar is just a Dirac bar. Okay? And so it's all the points that satisfy z bar z equals 0, which are real. You can easily see that it has to be a quadratic condition like that, because that's what's going to guarantee that the point x is Hermitian. You need some condition on the mu's and lambdas that says x is Hermitian. And so that's that z star, that z bar z is equal to 0. Okay. So that, and that of course isn't invariant under general SL4 transformations, but is exactly invariant under the SU2, 2 transformations, which are the real conformal group. Okay. So there's a five-dimensional real slice which satisfies this quadratic condition. And so if you want the point, so that's for the whole null ray. Okay. If you want the point in space-time, so you want to pick an A and a B that live in PN, so they have to satisfy Z bar A, ZA equals 0, Z bar A, ZB equals 0, Z bar A, Z bar B, ZB equals 0, as well as Z bar A, ZB equals 0, and Z bar B, ZA equals 0. Okay? You need four constraints because you start with a four complex dimensional point, and you need four constraints to find for a real dimensional point. And the constraints are simply that all of these quadratic forms between them are equal to 0. So if you want to, so that's it. So the real points are the ones that satisfy that z bar z is equal to 0 for all pairs. Okay. So for these, here, for us, we have to have that z bar a, z a equals 0, z bar a, z a plus 1 equals 0, and so on. All the consecutive ones have got to vanish, and they have to vanish when contracted into themselves. So you just have to ensure that condition is satisfied, and then all the points are real. Yeah. On which picture?
The relation between
curves. Well, yes. I mean, it's described very nicely in Hodge's original paper, it's reviewed in a variety of the other papers that are using these things. I think my very last paper with Freddie and Yaroslav Jarenka and Jacob Brugeli has an introduction to momentum twisters with the whole picture and the coordinates and the reality conditions and everything. So and it was meant to be, I think, relatively pedagogical. Okay. All right, so bottom line is that from this picture of the polygon, so let me recapitulate, from this picture of the polygon in space-time, once again, we go to a picture of intersecting lines in twister space. And so the twister momentum twister variables are ZA, or lambda A, or mu A, and lambda A. And that's the explicit formula that you can use to build lambda tildes that satisfy momentum conservation. It's a very simple exercise to show that that gives you momentum conservation. It's just a Schouten identity. Okay? So if you dot lambda tilde A into lambda A, just a tiny little Schouten shows that that's guaranteed to vanish. Okay? So that's a... okay. Now, I will just state without proof, but it's very reasonable, that this has a natural superextension. The superextension is to specify lambdas, mu's, I'm flipping things around, mu's, lambdas, whichever it is, and the fermionic coordinates, eta. These etas are not to be confused with the etas that we talked about before. So maybe just for this lecture, I'll call them phi's. Okay, phi A. These are new Grassmann variables. And these new Grassmann variables are related just like these guys. So the eta tildes are given by precisely the same formula involving the phi's. Okay? And so what this does, now specifying random mu, lambda, and phi gives me things that conserve momentum and conserve super momentum. So phi carries an index from 1 to 4, just like eta tilde does. Okay? So now we have points ZA that live in CP3/4. Okay? So 4 fermionic coordinates, and the bosonic coordinates live in CP3. Okay. All right, so let's go back and now start talking about the superamplitude. So remember, the superamplitude is a function of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. And we said it's very natural to factor out of this the delta function of momentum conservation, the delta function of the super partner of that. The part Taylor factor takes care of all the little group weights. Okay. And so what's left is also some function of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. Okay. So that's totally fine. This is MN and K. Okay. If you like, it's nice to put a K+2 here, because I'm taking out eight etas from here. So the number of etas in this guy is 2 less than the number of etas in this guy. So let me put a K+2 there, and let me call this guy RNK. So RNK is in principle a function of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. Really is what you get by stripping off the stupid obvious things from the superamplitude. Okay? Remarkable statement is that R and K, not the whole superamplitude. You see, it wouldn't make any sense for the whole superamplitude to be invariant under dual conformal transformations, because the whole superamplitude is defined for totally generic momenta that aren't conserved. But, you know, we have delta functions that impose those guys, right? So it's not something, it's not some totally general statement. It's only on support of the momentum conserving delta function and a superpartner that we even get to draw this polygon to begin with. Okay? So we can only talk about the symmetry on the support of these kinematic delta functions. Okay? So after stripping off those kinematic delta functions, the thing which is left, it's this RNK, is dual superconformal invariant. Okay, I'm talking about at all loops for the integrand and a tree level for the a tree level for literally the amplitude, but at all loops for the integrand. Okay. In any case, this is the object you look at to look for dual superconformal invariants. Now, what does this mean in practice? It means that even though it's written in terms of lambda, lambda tildes, and eta tildes, it needs to magically recombine so that you recognize that things are built out of four brackets, right? Things that take four Z's and combine them with epsilon symbols so that you can see they're SL4 invariant. Okay? You write them in terms of lambdas and lambda tildes, but they have to magically recombine to be written in terms of four brackets. So let me show you how spectacularly beautiful this is by writing the NMHV tree amplitude, which is that thing in components, and not that much more beautiful when you write the superamplitude. When you write the superamplitude, it still has those crappy things in the denominator, all these funny 4 plus 5, 5 plus 6 ones, all this stuff is sitting there. There's just a super delta function, and when you extract components, you get some of those numerator factors, but the denominator looks the same. Okay, I didn't write the superamplitude. But now I'm going to write down the superamplitude, actually all NMHV tree amplitudes in one line in terms of these momentum twister variables. And you begin to see, as I keep emphasizing, this very striking combinatorial structure to these objects emerging. Okay, so here are all NMHV tree amplitudes. So M, N, and K equals 1 is equal to the sum over I and J of following object, where I have to define what this funny bracket is. So this 5 bracket, I'll define for a general A, B, C, D, E, is equal to the delta 4 of phi A, B, C, D, E, plus cyclic, divided by A, B, C, D, B, C, D, E, C, D, E, A, D, E, A, B, E, A, B, C. And where this 4 bracket, I, J, K, L, let me just say A, B, C, D, is Z, A, I, Z, B, J, Z, C, K, Z, D, L, contracted with the epsilon symbol. Okay. So it's much simpler looking than that thing. Sorry? This is R. Sorry, I should have said this is R. Okay. That's R. Yeah. Yeah, but you see, this is NMHV. So perhaps I should have said R of N and K equals 0, which would be MHV, is just 1. Okay? So MHV is just 1, and NMHV is just the sum of these five brackety objects. Yeah, if you look at it at first, you might not think it's amazingly simple, but it actually is amazingly simple. This thing is actually the volume of a tetrahedron in CP4. Okay? So the amplitude is actually the sum of a bunch of volumes of tetrahedra. It's actually the volume of a nice little polytope that lives in CP4. No, there are certainly are traces of the spurious poles. There, in fact, let's talk about that. Yeah. No, there certainly are traces of the spurious poles. This basic object is interpreted as a volume with the delta function. Yes, it is a super volume, but this is a Grassmann object. So this is really a polynomial in the phis. Okay, right. But let's just look just for a second at what all the poles look like. See, the poles here look like 1 over ii plus 1, jj plus 1 is one of them. Then I have things like 1i, jj plus 1, 1i plus 1, jj plus 1, 1ji, well, 1i plus 1j and the other one, right? 1ii plus 1, j plus 1. Yeah? No, they're not. No, they're not. They're arbitrary. Yeah, I and j are totally arbitrary. And 1 is 1. So this expression is not manifestly cyclic. That's good because it's coming from BCFW, which is not manifestly cyclic. Okay, it's not a manifestly cyclic expression. Neither is BCFW. It is BCFW. I should have said, this is just the translation of the BCFW terms in momentum twister space. It's what they look like. So this is NMHV, okay? So the K here is N to the K MHV, okay? This new K is N to the K MHV, right? But if you just look at the poles, well, these are the poles we have downstairs. Now, this pole, so perhaps I should have said this earlier. Remember, we have a point X is associated with, let's say, ZA, ZB. And a point Y is associated with ZC, ZD. Okay, so here's AB in twister space and CD in general. And if these things don't intersect, then X and Y aren't null separated. That's fine. But actually, we can use the formula that I gave you to compute X minus Y squared. And what you find is that X minus Y squared is equal to the 4 bracket of ABCD divided by ABCD. These are the contracting the lambdas, lambda A, lambda B, lambda C, lambda D. The fact that the lambdas are contracted together, this breaks conformal invariance. That's good. X minus Y squared isn't a conformally invariant notion. So it's allowed to have these things that break conformal invariance. You see it has vanishing little group weight, which is good, because that does. But when these are non-separated, that's when A, B, C, D, when they intersect, that means when these guys are all coplanar, or the line AB intersects with C, D, right? So, but it also tells us that we can interpret each one of these ABCDs as some X minus Y squared, as being proportional to some X minus Y squared. The only one that corresponds to a physical pole is one that would be like XI minus XJ squared. Okay? Physical poles are things that look like, are poles in XI minus XJ squared along the in this polygon. Because XI minus XJ is a sum of all the momenta in between, I and J, in the polygon. So these are the only physical poles. Any other pole that doesn't look like II plus 1, JJ plus 1 is spurious. Okay? So there you have it. They're chock full of spurious poles. Okay? It only has one, each term only has one physical pole and 4 spurious poles in this picture. All right, but if nothing else, you should just see that it's some object that notice it's also a nicely anti-symmetric object. It's anti-symmetric in all of the indices. Okay. All right. So that's one example of what amplitude looks like in momentum twister variables. Let me give another example. Yeah, we can write down and we can write down those guys as well. I want to write down some loop integrands. Okay, so So MHV bar, yes, we can nicely write down MHV bar in this language. MHV bar, as you should expect, has the product of all these four brackets downstairs. See, it has all the product of all the four brackets downstairs because that's what's switching from all the lambdas downstairs to all the lambda tildes downstairs to go from remember, we factored out the MHV prefactor. For the whole amplitude to match, what happens is as you go to MHV bar, you just get downstairs all the product of all the cyclic four brackets, one after the other. And you get some very nice numerator that fixes it up. In fact, the numerator is nicest to write if you Fourier transform with respect to this phi variable, then it's just phi dot z, delta phi tilde dot z. And you can Fourier transform that guy back. So MHV bar is very nice. And the whole BCFW shift, everything looks beautiful in momentum twister language. Okay, so I won't talk about it, but we'll see. Well, yeah, that's I'm coming to that. I mean, I haven't told you why it's to be interpreted as a volume in any way. But all right. But I just want to say a final thing that how do we think about a loop integrand? Let's say at one loop we have a loop integrand is some d4x integral. Okay, a d4x integral. Once again, if we're doing everything quaestorially, we shouldn't think about integrals over points in space-time. We should be thinking about integrals over lines in momentum twister space. So associated with a loop integration point x, with every x, we associate a line AB. And so this is really some d4ZA, d4ZB over GL2, and then a 1 over lambda A, lambda B to the fourth. So that's what the d4x measure is. Okay. So I'm integrating over all the points except to remember to mod out by the GL2 so that I'm only talking about integrals over the line. And this has a weight upstairs of 4 in A and B, which I have to cancel out. And this isn't conformally invariant, so it's OK to have a lambda A, lambda B to the fourth down here. Okay. I should have mentioned, I said it in a rushed way at the end of the last lecture, the breaking of conformal invariance, I said, is associated with this infinity twister. This has a very simple interpretation. That, remember, that twister was some anti-symmetric matrix. That anti-symmetric matrix squares to zero. So you can think of it really as being just like a line, right? A line AB is really an anti-symmetric matrix because A and B each carry SL4 indices. Okay, so it's an anti-symmetric matrix because the line is an anti-symmetric matrix because it has to be invariant under GL2 transformations, so I have to anti-symmetrize it. So this infinity twister is nothing other than just some line in twister space. That some line in twister space is some point in space-time. So when we say we're breaking conformal invariance, we're saying that we're making one of the points in space-time special. What is that point? It's just a point at infinity. Okay. So when the theory is conformally invariant, we can add the point at infinity, and then we have conformal transformations acting on the whole compactified Minkowski space. If it's not invariant under conformal transformation, that means that there's a preferred point at infinity, okay. And that's what this. That's what this infinity twister is. It's just picking out a preferred point at infinity in space-time. It's a preferred line in the twister space. Okay. So a d4x is most certainly not by itself conformally invariant, and so that's fine. This measure is just this. But the beautiful thing is that if you take any of those nice dual conformally invariant integrals that Johannes was writing down, they're even easier to see to be dual conformally invariant in this language. For instance, let's look at this example that he wrote. Yes. Yes, this is the angle product, sorry. Lambda A, lambda B. Let's, yeah.
So it's related to your comments earlier about this conformal breaking sign.
Yes, exactly. And that's why you might expect to see subtle breakings of conformal invariance in twister space, because the scattering problem, the question, is breaking conformal invariance. The particles aren't coming out of the middle of the space. You know, the particles are coming in from infinity and going out to infinity. So there's a subtle breaking of conformal invariance that one should expect. So this is something that's not, there are parts of the sort of twister program where people got massively hung up for 30 years on all these little sort of fine points, okay? And part of the problem was that they weren't connecting to the data and the amplitudes to like know what to ignore and what to pay a lot of attention to. So somehow, you know, if you just plow ahead and ignore all these little subtleties, everything works. And then you go back and sort of back justify why these things are or aren't important. So, and anyway, this is an issue which rears its head first in twister space. The way it shows up in momentum twister space is not remotely as obvious. So everything we're going to write down in momentum twister space in the integrand, everything is perfectly conformally invariant. Okay. Yes, I is the only spurion, because that's the only thing which breaks conformal invariance to Poincaré. That's the only difference, right? There's a special point at infinity. That's all. And in fact, if you want to talk about not flat space but ADS or De Sitter space, it's just that you take this line at infinity isn't a line anymore. Making it a line means that this 4x4 matrix has determinant 0. If it has determinant 1 or minus 1, it's ADS or De Sitter. And it's the action of the conformal group in those two cases. So twisters are always useful for talking about conformal invariance in any situation. Okay? And it's just the choice of the point at infinity that tells you what the background is. Okay. Okay. I mean, the structure of the infinity twister that tells you what the background is. All right. So the integral Johannes wrote down, just in the simplest case, was d4x over x minus x1 squared, x minus x2 squared, x minus x3 squared, x minus x4 squared. And then to make this thing conformally invariant, so he put this point x here, right? There's x1, x2, x3, x4. Then you need to put a numerator factor, which is like x1 minus x3 squared, x2 minus x4 squared, for this thing to be truly conformally invariant. So that's the way Johannes wrote it. So this way you have to think and be smart and remember how inversions work and do it. Let's see how you can do it being dumb. You can be dumb using momentum twister variables. So we would write down d4x is just d4za, just that measure. Let's just write it down explicitly here. gl2 ab to the fourth. Now, each one of these factors, we just wrote what the formula is, right? I told you the formula for x minus y squared in general is a, b, c, d over a, b, c, d if x corresponds to z, a, z, b, and y to z, c, z, d. So this is nothing other than a, b, 1, 2 over lambda a, lambda b, which I'll just write as a, b without any danger of over 1, 2. Then the next one is a, b, 2, 3 over a, b, 2, 3, and so on. A, b, 4, 1 over a, b, 4, 1. And these numerator factors are just 1, 2, 3, 4 over 1, 2, 3, 4. And the next one is 1, 2, 3, 4 over 2, 3, 4, 1. So you see all of these crappy angle brackets disappear. And what you get is just beautifully d4za, d4zb over gl2, and just 1, 2, 3, 4 squared over ab, 1, 2, ab, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 4, 1. So in fact, if no one ever told you about this conformally invariant integral, you would have just built it. You would say, look, there's 4 a's and b's downstairs, so it has to have a weight 4 in a and b, just for it to be invariant, for it to have this GL2 symmetry. Okay. So this is what I write these things down. Then for it to have no weight in 1, 2, 3, and 4, I just put the only thing I can, which cancels it, which is 1, 2, 3, 4 squared upstairs. So that's the simplest, that's this very simplest box integral. So loop integrals are naturally expressed as integrals over lines in momentum twister space. Now, I should have stressed this before. Note that in going from standard variables to momentum twister variables and back, there's no funny Fourier transform, nothing. It's just this algebraic, trivial algebraic change. Okay? And so when I say I'm integrating over lines in momentum twister space, I can just trivially take it back and write it as a standard loop integral if I like. It's just that this way of writing it makes the conformal properties and other physical things totally transparent. Okay? Let me give another example. So here's a fun example. I'll tell you what I mean by these lines in a second. So I want to write down an integral. So now I want to do it from our end, if you like. Okay. So I want to write down something which is conformally invariant, but has six propagators downstairs. So I'll write them all down. AB12, AB23, AB61 downstairs. But now I have six A's and B downstairs, two upstairs. Oh, I'm going to tell you what the dashed lines are in a second. Okay. So you have to have some A's, two A's and two B's upstairs in order to make up the weights, right? Now, the most obvious thing that you could do, well, there are many things that you could do. You could write down some, in the usual coordinates, you'd write down X minus some outside X squared or something to make up the weights, right? So these dashed lines are just referring to the fact that I'm putting in the numerator AB26, AB35. Okay? So that's a way of doing it. That's certainly one thing I can put upstairs that soaks up all of the weights. Now, it turns out that, of course, again, this is a totally... I can once again go back and write this in terms of standard space-time integration variables. That's a slightly funny numerator from the usual point of view, because this 0.26, you see, in the usual variables, your eye is drawn to the points on the polygon. Okay, those are the nice real points, and that's fine. So if you're going to write numerators, you're going to refer them to the points that you see directly in the picture. This line 26 in twister space does not correspond to one of the points in the picture. It's some other points off in the complex plane somewhere. Okay. It has very natural, it's in fact one of the leading singularities of this diagram. It has lots of nice features, but it's just a complex point. It's not one of the points that you see in front of your face. Okay. So this is just as natural from this momentum twister point of view as any other loop integral. But it turns out that these objects, these sort of objects are very naturally the way the loop integrand wants to be expressed. So this is another place where the twistorial way of writing things is, while algebraically equivalent, is somehow more compact and is telling you about what the theory at least n equals 4 wants to do in a more transparent way. For instance, you'll notice that this thing is very chiral. Okay. So it's precisely because these points are complex, I'm picking out parity is complex conjugation. Okay. I'm picking out one of the, it's not parity symmetric. That's good because the amplitudes aren't parity symmetric. And yet when we model the amplitudes with normal scalar integrals, we're forcing the integrals to be parity symmetric. They can't match the integrand, which cannot be parity symmetric. So if you're going to try to match the integrand, you need these parity asymmetric objects. All right, so that's just an example of a very natural momentum twister integral, which is not so natural in more standard variables. There's another lovely thing about this integral. Most integrals that you write down with massless external particles are infrared divergent. This integral is completely finite. Okay. And you can see this by doing a little exercise. Which I will leave for whoever is interested to a look at. The infrared divergences are associated when the loop momentum variables become collinear with the external light-like momenta. In momentum twister language, those collinear divergences occur when the line AB passes through the point 1 while lying in the plane 612. Okay. So that's what the collinear regions are. When the line passes through one of the points while lying in the adjacent plane. So all you have to do in order to remove the infrared divergence is have a numerator that kills all such configurations, puts a zero in all such configurations. And you see, this little numerator factor does exactly that. Because if the line AB passes through 1 in the plane 612, then necessarily AB will intersect the line 26, and that factor is 0. If it passes through the point 2 while lying in the plane 123, well, heck, it passes through 2, so that guy is 0. All the collinear regions are killed by these numerator factors, and these integrals are finite. In fact, the vast majority of momentum twister integrals are finite, manifestly finite, and only a small fraction of them are divergent. And so I'm doing this so I can write down for you the Park-Taylor formula, at least for n equals 4 now, for MHV amplitudes, now extended to 3 loops. So as I mentioned, we now have control of the integrand to all loop order using BCFW, the generalization of BCFW recursion relations to all loops. And we have experience in how to write these answers in terms of these momentum twister objects. So what it looks like is the tree Park-Taylor formula. So there's a 1. And the one loop objects look like this. Sum over I and J. So everywhere I'm not specifying what the lines are, you can put any of the other particles in there at any of these other corners. Okay. So this is a pentagon, naturally a pentagon, not a box, but a pentagon integral. The two loop answer is this. The three loop answer And like I said, everywhere else you can put arbitrary numbers of legs in the middle. And the sum over all of, so anyway. And so on. So and with a little more, we could get the for loop, but we haven't done it. Okay? So the one loop is one object. You sum over these pentagons. There are these chiral momentum twister integrals. Okay? Two loop is one object. You sum over these, once again, there are these chiral momentum twister integrals. The three loop is two objects. And these objects are just jamming the same basic object together. So you take this, you take this object, you jam it, yeah. These are pentagons and that's a hexagon. These are all hexagons. Okay. And there are some ranges of, if I want to be very, it probably doesn't matter for your, yeah. So the way to not make it busy is to just not draw all of these. So you really put anything you want in between. What you have to pay attention to are where these massless legs are, these single lines are. And that's what the picture looks like with the, that's what the picture looks like with the single lines. Okay. So anywhere you don't see a single line, you can fill it in with any number of particles bigger than one. So it can't be a massless line, any number of particles that you like. But this is a right. Yes. Yes. No. This is for any number of particles. This is the amplitude for any number of particles. Any number of the MHV amplitude for it. No. Oh, sorry. No, you don't, because if you take these objects and you now start removing some of these, to go to fewer, you start removing some of the massless points. And these objects very nicely have the properties, you remove the massless points, they go down nicely to a lower object. So, in other words, the limit of these things as you start removing the massless guys turns one of those pentagons into a box, turns a hexagon into a pentagon, and so on. So that's really, this is really a literally correct formula. You take this, you take these objects, you take the limit, and it gives you the whole thing.
Okay.
Yes. Of course. Yes. Of course. Yes. But I want to stress that that this is the sort of computation that not only obviously it's impossible with Feynman diagrams, but even finding some nice basis, expanding in a basis, and so on, you don't see this amazing simple. I mean, I never thought that the three-loop MHV amplitude would be two terms, but it's two terms, and you see the basic simplicity working in these variables that are allowing the asymmetries to be as manifest as possible.
Okay?
Right. Yes.
Oh
yeah, it's all been supersymmetric. Yes. Everything is supersymmetric. Yeah. So that's all. That's all taken into here. And these are just the integrands. So literally everywhere here you have two integrands here, and you put this the same kind of funny numerator factor for this one and that one. Here are those numerator factors for these guys. Here and so on. Okay. So it's just that. They're naturally expressed in terms of these chiral momentum twister integrals with, right. Huh? Well, we have the whole integrand in principle, but recursively. This is doing something more. This is taking the result that you get from the whole integrand and is packaging it in a local form. I'm writing it, these are local integrals, okay? The BCFW gives you spurious things. It's completely remarkable, and we have no idea very deeply why. I mean, we know roughly why, but we don't deeply know why it's possible to take these spurious forms and repackage them to these shockingly simple local forms. Okay? So these are really local. They're momentum twistorial, but they're local integrals. They look like local space-time integrals. They're not manifestly unitary. So this is always the rub. So BCFW makes unitarity manifest, but it's not manifestly local. We now have manifestly local expressions for, like this, for there's a similar expression for the two-loop NMHV amplitudes, for example, it's two terms. They're manifestly local, but they're not manifestly unitary. So the sort of overarching picture seems to be that there is some object. The amplitude is something. It's like roughly a volume of something. And if you triangulate that volume in different ways, you get different representations of the amplitude. If you triangulate it one way, it's manifestly unitary, but not manifestly local. If you triangulate it another way, it's manifestly local, but not manifestly unitary. And that's a picture that we understand sort of perfectly for simple cases, and we're still struggling to try to generalize. But if you like, the sort of unitary part of the story is done, in the sense of there's a BCFW recursion for the all-loop integrand. But here, mostly, I mean, I just wanted you to see that these variables are useful. They make the tree amplitudes look simple. They make the loop integrands look simple. And there's clearly a structure to them. This is the integrand. This is the integrand. Yes. This is the analog. I mean, this is the analog of what of what you see all the time at one loop in all the beautiful results from many people in the room at two loop, three loop. I mean, you write things and it's some basis of integrals, right? That for n equals 4 in the planar limit, the basis of integrals, that the way the theory wants to write the integrals is in terms of these variables. And they're chiral, they're tensorial, but they're really naturally momentum tensorial, because the theory is a symmetry. I mean, it's there's not much else I can say. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. So that's the so of course you could do two things. One thing you could do is immediately go back from this form to the d4x form. That you can trivially do, right? That's just this algebraic change. Then you say the x's are real. Okay, good. You've gone back to expressing. Now you have a loop integral with some tensor numerators, and you have to learn how to integrate them. Alternatively, you need to learn how to leave it in this form and learn how to do these integrals on these real contours. And I really suspect that that's, for this theory, that's the way to go. I mean, I really have zero time to explain it, but something I think I mentioned earlier is not these local forms of the amplitude, but the BCFW forms of the amplitude are spat out in a way that are massively total derivatives when expressed in terms of these variables. The only reason they're not zero is because of this reality condition. It's because this reality condition is finding boundaries in the region of integration that you hit when you evaluate these total derivatives using Stokes' theorem. It's completely obvious that the integrals, in fact, on any reasonable contour, they would be zero or one or something trivial. They're only non-zero because of this reality condition. And so either we can just ignore that insight, translate it back to x variables, and treat them like normal loop integrals, or we can exploit that insight, but then we have to understand this interesting geometry of this quadric surface in twister space. And that's, I mean, many of us are working very hard on that right now. I really suspect that's the way to go. Okay. All right. So, but really, this was just to both show a sort of snapshot of the sort of results that are available now, as well as an illustration of the sort of utility of these variables. Okay. So that's the end of part one of my lectures. Now, let's see. So that's really all kinematics. In the sense that all we've well, this isn't kinematics, of course. I haven't told you how this. I haven't told you where that recursion relation comes from. But mostly we've been talking about kinematics. Now I'm not sure, Nastya, how you want to run things. I don't want anyone who's here out of politeness to feel the need to like stay. So should we stop and whoever wants to leave can leave?
Maybe you were saying something
about recursion. Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like to say something. Okay. Well, okay. What I was planning on doing next is talking about the way of thinking about these things that makes all the symmetries manifest and the connection to these new objects in algebraic geometry, Grassmannians, and things like that. And that'll make it a little bit easier to talk about the all-loop recursion relation. Even though the all-loop recursion relation is in principle independent of that, it's vastly easier to talk about it when all those ideas are in place. So I'm not disappearing entirely, but I will probably not be here sort of as of noon. So I'll be back like at 5 or 6, but so anyway, so that's what I was planning. It'll probably take another hour. So why don't we just stop? I mean, and anyone who wants to leave can leave. How about that? Is that okay? Huh? Great. So okay, good. Actually, let me grab some coffee.
So about this unshelled thing at the infinity.
Yes.
Is there a component to some paper to start with?
Sorry?
Is there a reference somewhere to?
Just my paper with Jared.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't believe you stayed for any of that, Johannes. What? You know. It takes a while. Huh? Yeah. I'm thinking. No. No, I'm not done. I'm not. Sorry, it's I It's sufficiently uncertain, and it's not up to me. So it's I just don't want to.
Okay.
It might be noon. It might be 11:30. It might be 11.
Yeah, then we should get people.
Yeah. Oh yeah, let me. I should have grabbed one.
You can start.
Okay, great. Oh, now she's back. Okay, great.
Well, you think it's great. I don't know. Maybe some people can come back.
Should we just start, Nasser?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. So actually, maybe just a little thing to just a little quick thing to motivate. If we write down this little object, A, B, C, D, E again, I gave you some explicit formula for it, which is this delta 4 phi A, B, C, D, E, plus cyclic over A, B, C, D, E. So there's five poles down there. And this thing is supposed to be dual superconformal invariant, right? Now, it's sort of obviously conformally invariant because it has these, all the dependence on the bosonic variables is in these four brackets. Okay, so the contractions with the epsilon symbol, so they're obviously conformally invariant. But actually, the super conformal invariance is not so trivial. I mean, you can check it. You can check it by applying a superconformal generator. By the way, in these twister variables, the generators are just like ZDDZ. Phi ddz, z dd phi, phi dd phi, they're all totally trivial, right? They're just linear generators. So you can check it, but it's not presented in a form that just sort of hits you over the head as being obviously super conformal invariant, okay? And actually, this is just an interesting problem. It's there are sort of many ways of getting into this discussion, but this is one of them, which is it's hard to write down super conformal invariants. It's very easy to write down conformal invariants. Pick any bosonic guys and contract them. But it's hard to write down super conformal invariants. If you just think about it, you can't just trivially supersymmetrize some four bracket made out of four bosonic guys. Okay? It's not that easy to write down things that are super conformal invariant. So part of the theme is to try to see how we can think about the physics in a way that makes all the symmetries as manifest as possible. Here, about the dual conformal invariants, and we see that the bosonic part is manifest. The super part is, you can check it, but it doesn't hit you over the head as being manifest. And certainly the original conformal invariants, forget about it, right? The original invariance is really not manifest at all. Okay? Just to say something Johannes said earlier, the conformal generators are like ZDDZ, super ZDDZ with the various components. But the other conformal generators in this language look like something that's like commutators of these things. The things that look like Z, I mean, I'm being very schematic, but they look like things like ZZ, DDZ, DDZ. Okay? And this is the first of an, so if you call the first set level zero generators, these are level one generators of this infinite dimensional Yang-Yin's image. Okay? But there, I don't want to go through it in detail in this language, but just to see that the original conformal symmetry you can in principle find by acting some very funny operator on this guy, but it's most certainly not totally manifest. Okay? And we wouldn't expect it to be for the usual physical reasons that I mentioned before. We're not going to see both symmetries totally obviously if we're committing to any one sort of space-time description or the other. Okay? So one motivation is to just figure out how to talk about the theory so that all the symmetries just hit you over the head and they're obviously there. To begin with, just the superconformal symmetries even, never mind the sort of whole Yang-Yin symmetry. Okay? All right. But in order to do that, we're now going to start talking about Grassmannians. And I'm going to motivate it in a very simple way. And it's a motivation that would start making you think about it, and is an easy way to see why it's an interesting thing to do. But maybe I'll jump to a small conclusion. I'll jump ahead of myself a little bit and just say why it is that Grassmannians enter the story at all. Okay? Grassmannians enter the story because the only way of writing superconformal invariants is in integrals over the Grassmannian. So let me so here is an obviously a superconformally invariant object. So if you have some twister variable, maybe I'll just say it. I'll just say it in words. We'll see what Grassmannians are. Well, we'll do it from this other motivation in a second. But just the words are that the only way of writing superconformal invariances are as integrals over the Grassmannian of some with some measure of this universal object that we'll talk about in a second. And so that's just to make superconformal invariants manifest. And then a very special, unique measure exists that makes everything fully Yang-Yin invariant. And there's a totally unique object. And in fact, in the past few months, through conversations with a bunch of mathematicians, we actually understand what this measure is intrinsically. Forget about purely from the point of view of the Grassmannian. There is some part, subspace of the Grassmannian, which is very interesting. And there's a unique form defined on that subspace of the Grassmannian. And that's the form that we've been talking about all this time. And perhaps, amusingly, we as physicists turned out to talk about it in a more coordinate independent language than the mathematicians did, which is why it took some time to see that it was the same thing, because they were presenting it in a particular coordinate system, and we had been writing it in some coordinate independent way. But anyway, there is some nice part of the Grassmannian, and there is this universal form on it, and this universal form on it is associated with Yang-Yin invariants and all the rest of these things. So I'm just saying this, you can ignore, if none of that makes sense, you can ignore it. But I'm about to tell a little story about momentum conservation and so on, which makes you think that there's all sorts of choices you could make along the way and do other things. But it's really just motivation. In the end of the day, there's sort of a theorem that this thing is the only way things can be. Okay? And there's really no other way of doing it. All right, so let's back up a lot. So forget about everything. Start all over again, and now just start thinking about some way that might give some theory for the amplitude, which isn't putting in the inside of the spacetime. This was the ideology that I was advocating anyway, right? So how might you begin such a project? Okay. Well, to begin such a thing, it pays a lot to think about momentum conservation. And that sounds funny because momentum conservation is so trivial that we normally factor it out right away when we do amplitude calculations. But it's trivial precisely because we have the inside of the spacetime. Momentum conservation is so obvious because we have that d4x integral in every Lagrangian calculation, and it's that d4x integrated over all spacetime that gives us momentum conservation. If we're not going to have the inside of the spacetime, then momentum conservation is going to look interesting. It's not going to be trivial. And that's the way things normally are, right? What's trivial in one language will be the hard part in the other language and vice versa. So if you're not going to put in the inside of the space-time to talk about scattering, it makes sense that that momentum conservation is going to be something interesting to think about. Okay? And we even see that right away just in what momentum conservation is on shell, right? As we keep saying, momentum conservation is this interesting quadratic statement that the sum of lambda, lambda tilde is equal to zero. That's not a trivial constraint. It's a quadratic constraint on the external data. Okay. So I want to think about momentum conservation in a slightly different way. To begin with, I want to think about the external data, the lambdas and the lambda tildes, in a slightly different way. So we normally think, well, there's n two-dimensional vectors for the lambdas and n two-dimensional vectors for the lambda tildes. But let's now think instead, pick any fixed Lorentz component, the first Lorentz component, like alpha equals 1. Okay? All the data of the first Lorentz component of these vectors, of these two-dimensional vectors, itself forms some n-dimensional vector in an n-dimensional space, where n is a number of particles. So now I'm living in an n-dimensional space, and I'm going to draw the n-dimensional vector that corresponds to the first Lorentz component of each one of the lambdas, right? Is that n-dimensional vector clear? Michael seems unhappy.
But,
huh? No, 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 no. This is just the lambdas. So this is an n-dimensional vector whose first component is lambda a equals 1, 1. Lambda a equals 2, 1. Lambda a equals 3, 1. The top Lorentz component, lambda a equals n, 1. That's some n-dimensional vector in the n-dimensional space of particles, right? And there's another one for the second Lorentz component. Okay. So there's two n-dimensional vectors in this in some n-dimensional space. Now, we have Lorentz transformations. Lorentz transformations act on the lambdas like SL2. So what does SL2 do? It takes a linear combination of these two vectors, right? But it's the same linear combination for every single one of the components. It's a global transformation, right? So that means that it's taking this two vector and that two vector and doing any 2x2 linear transformation on these vectors. That's SL2. So in one Lorentz frame, the vectors will look like that. Another Lorentz frame, the vectors look like that. But the one thing which is Lorentz invariant is the two-plane that's spanned by lambda of the first and the second component. So the Lorentz invariant data isn't the individual vectors, but is a plane, is a two-dimensional plane in this n-dimensional space. Okay. So let's draw that two-dimensional plane. So there's a lambda two-plane. See, already, just talking about the external data, we're starting to find it convenient to talk about k-planes and n-dimensions. In this case, the external lambdas are specified by giving a two-plane in n-dimensions. The space of k-planes in n-dimensions is called the Grassmannian, gk, n. And so we just see the external data for the lambdas is an element of g2, n. It's a particular two-plane in n-dimensions. Okay. Now, what about the lambda tildes? There are some other two-plane in n-dimensions. And momentum conservation is the statement that these two planes are orthogonal to each other. Right, because it's sum over all a, lambda tilde a equals zero. So that means you take any vector in one plane, dot it into any vector in the second plane, it's equal to zero. So these two planes are orthogonal to each other. Actually, there's no Euclidean structure here. There's no orthogonality. Really, the statement is that the lambda tilde plane is in the complement of the lambda play. Okay. So, but we can say it in this Euclidean language if we'd like. Okay. So this is what the external data looks like in n dimensions. Lorentz invariantly, there's a two-plane, there's another two-plane, and they're orthogonal to each other. All right, so let me just redraw it. I'm going to compress the two planes so that they look one-dimensional. So this is the lambda two-plane, and here's the lambda tilde two-plane. Okay. So now what I want to do, so that is a quadratic constraint. Now what I want to do, now I'm going to do something new. This is just momentum conservation. But now I'm going to do something, now I'm going to start making a guess. Now I'm going to start doing something a little different. So I want to think about momentum constant. This quadratic constraint is actually arising from a pair of linear constraints. Not that lambda and lambda tilde, God given, were forced to be orthogonal to each other, but that they each had a relationship to some third object that forced them to be orthogonal to each other. So what I'm going to do is introduce a third character into the game, which is a general k-plane in n dimensions. So here's a general k-plane. Let's call it CK. And I want to demand that CK contains the lambda 2-plane. Oops. And that CK is orthogonal to the lambda tilde 2-plane. Well, it's k-dimensional. We'll talk about the very special cases in a second, okay? So CK contains lambda and is orthogonal to lambda tilde. Clearly, that forces lambda and lambda tilde to be orthogonal to each other, okay? But now I'm doing it by not making lambda and lambda tilde talk to each other directly, but talk to each other via a third party, namely CK, okay? Now let's talk about a couple of special cases right away. When k equals 0 or k equals 1, this is obviously impossible. We can't have a point contain the 2-plane, or a line contain the 2-plane. So whatever this is 0. That's good, because this k is going to be the k of the scattering amplitudes. And if you remember, in the supersymmetric theories, the amplitudes for k equals 0 and k equals 1 vanish. Okay, so that's fine. Okay. Now, this picture seems to make an asymmetry between lambda and lambda tilde. That's bad because parity exchanges lambda and lambda tilde, right? But no, that's also fine because this is actually, you see, associated with the k-plane in n dimensions, there's a natural complement n minus k-plane, sort of orthogonal complement. And so this statement I can read completely equivalently is that this orthogonal complement n minus k plane contains lambda tilde and is orthogonal to lambda. It's exactly the same statement. So parity is also okay. Parity is simply flipping lambda and lambda tilde and at the same time flipping the k plane with its naturally conjugated n minus k plane, with its naturally paired complement n minus k plane. Okay. So whatever we're doing is so far so good. Okay. Sorry? No, the dimension of c tilde is n minus k. Then it also doesn't work. That's good, because a point can't. So remember, when k equals 0 or 1 or n minus 1 or n by parity, those amplitudes all vanish. So everything is okay so far. Okay, so now let's just try to write this picture in equations. incidentally, I mean, I should say, it's not so the sort of fact that there's lots of juice in the momentum-conserving delta function. I mean, where all this came from was looking at BCFW recursion relations, translating them into twister space, seeing that they did something very, very nice in twister space, and then realizing that in twister space, individual BCFW terms had a graphical interpretation. These graphical interpretations turn out to be these things that Penrose called twister diagrams in 1972. In 1972, Penrose had this idea that there should be something like Feynman diagrams in twister space that he called twister diagrams. And very early on, it was sort of clear the twister diagrams for Compton scattering were summing Feynman diagrams. They were gauge invariant all by themselves. But again, they got tangled a lot in their shoelaces because these are contour integrals, high dimensional, twister space, all this sort of stuff. And so Penrose didn't pursue them much further, but well, he did. But the person who really pushed them a lot was Andrew Hodges, who was a student. And Hodges started, especially after started seeing lots and lots of wonderful structure in these twister diagrams. Tons of wonderful structure in these twister diagrams. These famous twister newsletters in Oxford are filled with these just beautiful little notes by Hodges on incredible things about these twister diagrams. Of course, absolutely no one was paying attention. And then after twister string theory and after BCFW, after twister string theory, there was a big uptick of interest in twisters, which sort of died very quickly because people thought it was all dead at loop level and it was sort of complicated. And besides, all these wonderful calculational techniques had nothing to do with twisters. You could go ahead and compute. And especially BCFW, I think, killed off interest in twisters because that seemed to have absolutely nothing to do with the twister methods at all, not even like the CSW rules that were inspired by the twister string. So I think after BCFW, most people thought that twisters were really dead, except for Hodges, who said, no, it's exactly the other way around. These BCFW things, what I've been looking for all this time, these are twister diagrams. And he's exactly correct. Everything he said after that point was precisely correct. It took us a while to decode it. But he was doing all sorts of, for example, the supersymmetric BCFW formula he had right away. He had before any of us. And it was all correct. His formulas were correct. His papers were unreadable. But not through just major communication barriers. But so that's what they were. These twister diagrams from 40 years ago were really BCFW terms. But anyway, in a more pedestrian way, just following our nose and transforming into a twister space, we realized that in trying to compute these diagrams. In trying to compute the BCFW terms in twister space, we needed some nice diagrammatic notation. And slowly, we started reconstructing what Hodges diagrams look like the whole time. So that's how we knew to pay a lot of attention to what these diagrams look like. And one of the persistent themes in this business was the delta function. The momentum-conserving delta function was the tough part of the twister diagrams. And once you got the momentum-conserving delta function right, the rest of it was decoration. But you really had to. But all the juice was in the momentum-conserving delta function. So this was something that we were very primed for. The idea that this is where most of the magic is. Yes. Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. I mean, this is considered by many people, I think, the definitive scientific biography of Alan Turing. And anyway, he's an absolutely spectacular person. So, and he's written some lovely, lovely, if you go to the bookstore, there's a beautiful popular book on number theory that he put out a couple of years ago, which is just spectacular. Well, I think by now everyone knows to pay attention to his papers, a lot of attention to his papers, but it was not so obvious 5 years ago. But those of us who fell under his spell, you know, 3-4 years ago, got lots and lots of mileage out of it. And so I just want to say again, this idea that there's excitement of the delta function is a persistent theme in this 30-year literature. It sounds sort of ludicrous that we're going to get anything out of momentum conservation, but that makes it much more it made it more reasonable. Of course, the it should be hard from this other point of view is also correct, but it was really concretely there in this old literature. Anyway, let's proceed. So we want to write this picture in pictures. So to write it in pictures, I want to write down a delta function that said, before doing that, let's just do it. Before doing that, how are we going to talk about a k-plane? To talk about a k-plane, you know what? From now on, my alpha, I'm no longer going to write Lorentz indices on these guys explicitly. So my alpha now is going to be a variable that runs from 1 to k. I apologize. So how do I specify a k-plane? Well, I give you k vectors, k n-dimensional vectors that span the plane. Okay? So let me take the first k-dimensional vector, I put in the top row of the matrix, the second one in the second row, and so on. Okay? So I give you k n-dimensional vectors. Here's the first one, the second one, the third one. The span of these vectors defines the plane. So to give a k-plane in n dimensions, I have to give you a k by n matrix. So let's call this matrix C alpha A. So A runs from 1 to n, alpha runs from 1 to k, like I said. Okay? However, this is a redundant description of the plane, because if I do any k by k transformation, linear transformation, any linear transformation on the vectors, it's going to give me the same vector back, the same plane back. So anything I do with this has to be invariant. It has to be invariant. We need a gauge symmetry. The gauge symmetry is that we have to identify C alpha A with any k by k linear transformation on the alpha index. Okay? So L is in GLK. So we have a GLK gauge symmetry. So anything we do with this matrix, it better be invariant under GLK transformations in order for it to be about the plane. Alright, so now how am I going to write that picture? I'm going to write a factor delta squared C alpha A lambda tilde A, product over all the alphas. This is guaranteeing that C is orthogonal to lambda tilde. Okay. Now I have to write something that guarantees that C contains lambda. This is slightly trickier. How do I know if C contains lambda? Well, I know if there's some linear combination of the k vectors in C that I can take which are equal to the lambda 2 vectors, the lambda 2 plane. So what I have to do is integrate So what is this factor? Product over all A. That's right. So I have this row has a Lorentz index, the same Lorentz index as A, and there's K of them. Okay? And so I'm looking to see, can I find two linear combinations of the C's, one linear combination which is equal to the first Lorentz component of lambda, linear combination which is equal to the second Lorentz component of lambda. So I'm hunting around by integrating over all possible linear combinations, just integral over rho, to see if it's possible to find linear combinations of the k vectors to equal the lambda vector. Okay? So this is enforcing C orthogonal to lambda tilde, and this is enforcing C contains lambda. So now it looks like we're done. But there's a small problem. This thing is not really, this is not invariant in the GLK gauge symmetry. It's not invariant, it's invariant into SLK, but it's not invariant under the overall rescaling of C. Okay, so if C goes to some constant times C, this is not invariant. That's because the delta functions pick up a weight. Right? So I pick up a weight negative 2k from this guy, and I pick up a weight from that guy. Right? So what do I do? We can either stop, or we can say, no, I want to insist that this is about k-planes. So what I'm going to do is just add some fermionic variables to cancel that Jacobian. So far we didn't talk about supersymmetry. But now, purely from the desire to talk about this picture of planes, it's motivated to find something to cancel this Jacobian. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to multiply by another product over alpha of a delta 4 C alpha A eta tilde A. I'm going to introduce some new fermionic variables, eta tildes. And now this thing is invariant under GLK. Well, we're not integrating anything yet. We have just have a C. This is the only integral that we have so far, right? This is just trying to say that picture in words, say that picture in equations. And we found that we couldn't say that picture exactly bosonically because of this stupid weight of the delta functions. And so we're forced to repair it by adding some fermionic variables. There is, of course, there is. What you can do purely bosonically is to start multiplying by C's to make up the weights. And that ultimately is what picking out components will do. But if you don't want to mess up the cyclic symmetry, then this is, or if you don't want to mess up, at this point, we don't have a cyclic symmetry. If you don't want to mess up the permutation symmetry, then this is the thing that you do. In fact, in the end of the day, sort of non-supersymmetrically, well, we'll come to it. Yes. I mean, ultimately, of course, you know we can project out components and say it supersymmetrically. But this is the way of saying it, which keeps it just as a geometric statement about without breaking the permutation symmetry. Like I said, non-supersymmetrically, we know in the end of the day these are going to be amplitudes with helicities. And, of course, specifying the helicities is breaking the permutation symmetry anyway. So that's why it's okay to have that. But at this point, if we don't want to do that, we're not going to do it. Sure. Yes. Right. Sure. Yes. I agree. No. Huh? Well, naively not. Yeah, definitely naively not. Okay. So, and I hope it's clear that this makes up all the weights, right? So we can count them. There's a weight negative 2k here. From here. When I rescale the C, I can make up for it by rescaling the rho. So there's 2k here, there's 2k here, and there's a minus 4k from here, because there's 4 of the etas. So that's why I have to have 4 etas here. Okay? So etas, I is going to run from 1 to 4. Okay?
Does this picture suggest some geometric extension of the picture?
Not really. No, you mean with the lambda tilde? Well, I mean, I guess, yeah, in some sense, there's also some eta tilde plane that this is orthogonal to, but it's not very useful. Okay, so this is the object that's encoding that picture. It doesn't look particularly nice, but let's make it look a little bit nicer and expose the property of it by looking at what it would look like in twister space. So let's Fourier transform this thing into twister space. And what I'm going to Fourier transform is the one that's natural. I'm going to Fourier transform with respect to lambda. That's the thing that has this funny, ugly integral in it. The rest of it looks sort of nice, but that integral looks funny. So let's Fourier transform with respect to lambda. We'll call the conjugate variables mu tilde. Well, if we Fourier transform with respect to lambda, we can do the rho integral. And what do we get? So Fourier transform with respect to the lambdas, so e to the I lambda a mu tilde a, so these are the conjugate variables. And so what I get is just the product over all alpha, delta squared, so the ones that were there already, lambda tilde a, But this thing just turned into delta squared, again, C alpha A, mu tilde A. And I have my delta fermionic for C alpha A, eta tilde A. That's what you get after Fourier transformation. So after Fourier transformation, you see that these things actually are grouping into one big supervector. This is nothing other than the product over all alpha, delta 4/4 of C alpha A times some WA, where WA is a super twister, mu tilde, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. So this funny picture of momentum conservation with the planes in twister space looks even more natural. It's just saying that this K-plane is orthogonal to the whole super twister plane, the 4/4 plane of super twisters, WA. That's it. Yeah. Well, a couple of things. You see, as I say, in a sense, the sort of biggest stumbling block was a sort of sociological one, that they did not know what was going on with scattering amplitudes, with what people had actually been computing. I mean, it's a tragically sad fact that Hodges did not know about the Park-Taylor formula until 2004. Okay? And he said, had he known it before, it would have like lit things up like very, very quickly. Because so that's one problem already. But there's perhaps a deeper point, which is that this is not, in the end of the day, as you'll see, the kind of star of the interesting new object here is not twister space. Twister space is just a basis. It's just a very nice basis that makes it easy to see what's going on. But it's not something that lives in twister space. It's something that lives in this other space. I mean, all the action is going on in the Grassmannian. Twister space is a window into it. And there's a particularly nice window into it, but you could also do it in momentum space. You could do it in momentum twister space, in original twister space. It just made it very easy to see what's going on, to see conformal properties and things like that. But going one step further, all these wonderful properties that Hodges was seeing in his twister diagrams, and we now very literally see that those properties were reflecting, were sort of seeing this Grassmannian structure in a particular GLK gauge. Okay. So he had all sorts of properties. He could draw diagrams this way, draw them that way, their identities that related them to each other and stuff like that. And many of those things just seem to be the same Grassmannian object in different gauges, in different GLK gauges, for example. So the structure that he was saying was really, and they also sort of knew that. They kept saying they're looking for some dynamical principle, something that told them what to do, what diagrams to draw, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't just saying the words twister space and that's it. You needed some principle on top of it. And so the structure in the twister diagrams was indeed reflecting this. But really, I think the bigger point is just that this the sort of intellectual isolation. Had the data flowed in that direction, it would have been. I think stuff would have really started happening earlier.
Yeah.
No, that's not. As far as I know, that is not what happened. As far as I know, it is a total coincidence that Mr. Grassmann is showing up in two different places in this story, in his standard variables and in the planes. Right. Although I should say that algebraic geometers love Grassmann variables, and one of the reasons they love Grassmann variables is, I don't understand it in great detail, but I think it's things like this. It allows you to talk about It's these Jacobians. It's canceling these Jacobians. Of course, they don't quite talk about it this way. They talk about it instead of some power series. You know, they talk about it in the polynomial expansion in Adas instead. But it's really the same thing. At least in my conversation with them, they love these odd variables. So, and they're very natural to them. So it's okay. All right. So one thing this makes clear is that, first of all, it's very pretty. But But more importantly, this is manifestly superconformal invariant. And in fact, it's the only thing that's manifestly superconformal invariant that you could imagine. I told you it's hard to write down superconformal invariants. One thing that's sort of obviously superconformal invariant is a delta function with four bosonic and four fermionic variables to cancel any Jacobian. So a delta function of one bosonic of one supervariable is clearly superconformal invariant. A delta function of any linear combination of these supervariables is clearly superconformal invariant. So this is clearly a superconformally invariant object, and it has weight zero, so it's about gluons. So from here we see n equals 4 and spin 1, okay? And superconformal symmetry. Okay? Sorry? Yes, the way you see gluons is that this thing has a property how do you see what helices are? You see what it does under little group transformations, right? So in the little group transformations, W goes to TW, this is invariant, okay? And the amplitude being invariant in twister space is spin 1. So that's how you tell that it's gluons. All right. But we're not quite done yet, because this is just for one such configuration. But in general, there'll be many planes that satisfy this property. Okay? So we need to integrate over the space of all k planes in n dimensions to integrate over all such configurations, because there's no one of them is a preferred. So to finish the story, we have to have an integral over the space of k planes in n dimensions. So I'm going to have to integrate over all these guys modulo GLK. Of this product over alpha delta 4/4 C alpha A WA. But once again, I have a problem, because this measure isn't invariant under GLK transformations. It's invariant under SLK transformations, but it's not invariant under the overall rescaling, again. Okay? Just dk times n. If I take c goes to constant times c, it picks up constant to the kn. Okay? It's not invariant. So I need to have k times n c's downstairs in order to make up the weight. Obviously, I can't just multiply by each element individually, because that's not invariant under SLK. Forget GLK, just even SLK. So what are the things that are invariant under SLK? Things that are invariant under SLK are the minors of this K by N matrix. So if I take this K by N matrix, and I now think of it as sort of column 1, column 2, column 3, up to column N, then if I take any determinant of any columns, like 1, 3, 4, 7, 9, okay, if k equals 5, then this is at least SLK invariant. Okay, so in general, if I take epsilon, alpha 1, alpha 2, up to alpha k, c alpha 1, a 1, c alpha 2, a 2, up to c alpha k, a k, and I denote this by a 1, a 2, up to a k, that's just taking those k columns and taking the determinant. This is SLK invariant. Okay. So any measure I build has got to be built out of the minors of this k by n matrix. All right, so now we need to, and we have to have the minors downstairs, right? Because they have to make up the minors when you transform, rescale the c's, pick up, have some weight into rescaling the c's. So we have to have n minors downstairs. All right, so what's the simplest thing that we could do to have n minors downstairs? Well, here the simplest is in the eye of the beholder, but I'll write something down, and then later we'll talk a little bit more about it. But let's just take the first k columns. Okay? And now the next k. and keep going until the last k consecutive columns. Okay. So here I'm really making a choice, right? Here, I mean, there's lots of things that you could write down that would be GLK invariant. Okay? But this somehow looks like a particularly nice choice. I take the first k columns, that determinant, then the next one, the next one, the next one, the next one. So this has a natural cyclic structure. This is the first place in the discussion we've broken permutation invariance on all the external particles. But we can keep a cyclic structure. And that's good because in the back of our minds, the amplitudes have a cyclic structure. Okay? So, all right. So now you see we have enough of them downstairs that this makes up for the weight of this guy. And so that's it. Let's stop and we'll call this something. I guess. I mean, if you're trying to come up with some, and in fact, in the newer way of thinking about this object, that cyclic structure is really emergent as well. But here we're just screwing around. Okay. So all right. Okay. So here I've written this formula in twister space. We can of course immediately bring it back to momentum space, because I mean all the dependence on the external world is in this factor. We can bring it back to momentum space immediately if we want. Just undo what we did. This form just makes it clear that it's superconformal invariant, whatever it is. We can bring it back to a momentum space and do any computations we like. And then what you find is that you solve for many of these variables on the support of the delta function. What you're left with is a lower dimensional integral. In fact, we know how many dimensions it has. Because from our picture, we know that this k-plane is forced to contain a two-plane and be orthogonal to another two. Oh, sorry, something I should have done is tell you right away, what is the dimensionality of GKN, of this Grassmannian? Well, it's k times n, which is the number of elements of this k by n matrix, minus k squared from the GLK redundancy. So this is k times n minus k. That nicely has this k to n minus k symmetry, okay, which it should have. Right? So we even know how many integration variables are there. The number of integration variables is really, that picture tells us what our independent freedom is. This k-plane is forced to contain lambda. It's forced to be orthogonal to lambda tilde. So really, it has the degrees of freedom of a k minus 2 plane that lives in n minus 4 dimensions, because it has to be orthogonal to both lambda and lambda tilde now. The rest of it has got to be orthogonal to both lambda and lambda tilde. So the number of degrees of freedom is equal to the dimensionality of g k minus 2 n minus 4, which is k minus 2 n minus k minus 2. Okay? So on the support of all those delta functions, after you solve for them, you end up having an integral which is that many dimensional. Okay? For example, let's do the simplest case. When k equals 2, there's no integral to do, right? That's good, because when k equals 2, there's a unique plane that contains the lambda 2 plane, namely the lambda 2 plane. Right? So what does this integral give us? When k equals 2, our consecutive minors downstairs are 1 over the minor 1, 2, the minor 2, 3, the minor 3, 4, up to the minor n, 1. When this 2 plane happens to be the same as a lambda 2 plane, that means that this 2 plane is exactly the same as the lambdas. So the minor 1, 2 is the same as angle bracket 1, 2. The minor 2, 3 is the same as angle bracket 2, 3. And this is how this reproduces the Park-Taylor formula for k equals 2. So these consecutive minors downstairs are just turned into the Park-Taylor factor. But as you go to higher k, of course, that isn't true anymore, and there are integrals to do. Okay? For example, the first case is k equals 3, n equals 6, the 6-point NMHV amplitude. Okay? Yeah. Exactly, that's right. Right, exactly. So that's now right. So look, I'm coming exactly to that. Right. So that's in fact exactly what I was going to say. When k equals 3 and n equals 6, there's one integral to be done here. And yeah. Yes. The counting is, we could do it many ways. How many delta functions are there in total in this picture? There's 2n minus 4 delta functions. There's naively 2n delta functions, but four of them are redundant because of momentum conservation. So there's 2n minus 4 delta functions. And so you have k times n minus k minus 2n minus 4. Okay, so that's one way of doing the counting. The other way of doing the counting is just very even more geometrically. Look at that picture. This k-plane must contain the two-plane. So that part is locked. So the other part of the k-plane isn't in the lambda 2 direction. It isn't in the lambda tilde direction, so it's orthogonal to both of them. Right, so it's living in n minus 4 dimensions, and it's k minus 2 of them. So it's the same as the dimensionality of k minus 2 planes in n minus 4 dimensions. Okay. Right. Okay. So, but that's the point. In general, this is a contour integral. And what do we do? What do we do with these integrals? We compute residues of this integral. Okay. So we compute residues of this integral. And you see, for any k and n, there are some finite set of residues. Right? You just pick out, you get a finite set of algebraic functions. Again, they're algebraic because we're solving polynomial equations. You get a finite set of algebraic functions out of this. Okay? So the claim is that this set of algebraic functions, the residues of this integral, is in one-to-one correspondence with all of the leading singularities of n equals 4 super Yang Mills to all loop order. Okay, so remember
yes.
Well, because everything is holomorphic, and any other way you do the integral gives you nonsense. So yeah. So you know it's right exactly. So yeah, so really it's not an integral. I mean, it's all algebraic operations. This integral is a very formal symbol. It's like any contour integral is not an integral. All you're really doing is computing a Jacobian. And, right. So
somehow, in this original geometric picture,
the Yes. Yeah, everything was complex to begin with. Right. Everything was complex to begin with. Everything was complex to begin with. Yeah. So anyway, that's a claim. The claim is that the residues of L and K are all the leading singularities of n equals 4 to all loop order. And now, in fact, by now we know this is true, and we in fact know how every leading singularity in n equal every picture, any leading singularity picture you draw, we know precisely which residue it is. There's a picture for what all the residues are. In fact, what this measure is, what the space is, everything. But anyway, that's the most zeroth order claim. Now, but what's really interesting about this is already an interesting statement. Okay, and remember, I told you there's a number of remarkable things about the set of leading singularities. One of them is that they run out. You only have one for MHV amplitudes. You only get the MHV tree amplitude. When you compute all these diagrams, all the time you get the MHV tree amplitude. That's completely obvious here, because well, for any n and k, there's no L, there's no loop order here. For any n and k, there's a totally finite set of objects you get. So you fix n, fix k, that's it. There's a suite of objects you get, nothing more. You go to 100,000 loops, it doesn't make any difference. So it makes that property completely manifest out of time. That's a property that's very unobvious from a field theory, but it makes that property totally obvious out of time. The other property, you remember I told you these things have to satisfy relations. Like there was that six-term identity that we talked about, right? That six-term identity is just Cauchy's theorem in this language, okay? So we have this contour integral, and Cauchy's theorem for this contour integral are where all the identities come from. Cauchy's theorem and higher dimensional analogs of Cauchy's theorem is where all the identities come from. So these identities are what encode locality and unitarity. So locality and unitarity is being encoded in contour deformation arguments in the Grassmannian. Okay, but the final interesting thing about this is that, in fact, these residues, piece by piece, are actually both conformal and dual conformal invariant. And in fact, if you'd never heard of dual conformal symmetry or momentum twisters or any of that stuff, you would discover it by staring at this object just a little bit more. In fact, we can discover it right now by looking at that top picture and noticing something really stupid about it. Here we're saying that this k-plane must contain the lambda 2-plane and is orthogonal to the lambda tilde 2-plane, right? So why are we being so dumb as to integrate over all k-planes? It's forced to contain the lambda 2-plane. So shouldn't we integrate over k minus 2-planes instead? Just, you know, fix that it contains the lambda 2-plane and just integrate over the k minus 2-planes, okay? Now that's something that you might imagine doing. No problem. You can definitely do that. You can sort of fix a gate. You can make the k-plane contain the top. You can make the sort of top two rows of this k-plane be the same as the lambda plane. But it's not obvious that the resulting thing that you'll get is really an integral over k minus 2 planes, because the measure of integration, if it's going to turn into an integral over k minus 2 planes, the measure of integration would need to involve the k minus 2 by k minus 2 minors. And here we're starting with the k by k minors. So if you put completely a totally random measure here, a totally random measure would be superconformal invariant, but you would not be able to actually descend from k planes to k minus 2 planes. Okay. However, this special measure allows you to do it because of this trick that many of us learned in high school for how to compute determinants of big matrices. Okay. Before Mathematica, right? So if you want to compute the determinant of a matrix, you do this thing where you take linear combinations of the of a row with one of its neighbors to set the top component to zero, and then the next one to set that component to zero. You do this linear transformation, so you set all of them to zero except one of them at the top, and then what's left is just that multiplied by the matrix at the bottom, right? Okay, so we just do the same trick but with two. Okay, so we want to go down two. So we take linear combinations of a column with the guy to its left and the guy to its right, and we keep going until we set the top two rows to zero, until we get to the, for any k by k minor, we do this linear transformation. So we set the top two rows to zero, except for the two ends. And then for that minor, it's equal to just this little 2 by 2 determinant of these guys at the top times a k minus 2 by k minus 2 minor. Now, you can do that for any fixed minor. However, the cyclic structure guarantees that exactly one unique linear transformation allows that to happen for every single one of these minors. And every one of these minors goes down from k by k to k minus 2 by k minus 2 minors. Okay? That linear transformation on the columns that you do through those delta functions imposes a linear transformation on the lambda tildes. That linear transformation on the lambda tildes is precisely the one that takes you from the lambda tildes to the momentum twister variables that I showed you. Remember, lambda tilde A was mu A plus 1, A minus 1, A plus dot, dot, dot. That's just a little linear transformation. That's literally the one that that goes from K by K minors to K minus 2 by K minus 2 minors. So if you take this just geometric picture and do what it begs you to do, which is to reduce it down to a K minus 2 dimensions, what you find, reducing down this k to minus two dimensions, is back in momentum space, you find that lnk of lambda tilde and eta tilde ends up being, you see, from the fact that you've made C contain the lambda plane, you've made momentum conservation completely manifest from the top two rows of these delta functions, similarly for its superpartner. These little determinants I told you about combined to a Jacobian factor that exactly gives you the Park-Taylor denominator. And what's left ends up being an integral over k minus 2 planes. So let's call those things D, with k minus 2 by k minus 2 minors. And what's inside here is delta 4/4 of d alpha a times the momentum twister variable za. So you discover just doing this geometric, just doing what the geometry asks you factors out the Park-Taylor, super Park-Taylor factor in front, and what it leaves you with is an integral over k minus 2 planes in n dimensions of exactly the same structure, just replacing k with k minus 2, and the twisted variables with momentum twisted variables. And that means that the object is manifestly dual superconformal invariant. So we see the conformal and the dual conformal invariances at the same time. Sorry? No, there's no trees here. This is there's no loop anything here. I'm just talking about these integrals. Okay? So these integrals give you objects that are conformal and dual conformal invariant. The claim is that the residues of this object, it's a multidimensional contour integral, the residues are compute all the leading singularities of n equals 4 super of n equals 4 amplitudes all loop orders. Okay? Okay, so now we have to talk about what the now we have to understand and classify what all the residues are, what they look like, and how every leading singularity matches up with every residue. So that's a story we know the answer to, but which I would have to tell you. But we know precisely which leading singularity goes with which residue, and vice versa. Right. So there's a separate question, which is there some question, some nice question that, for example, the contour that gives you the tree amplitude is the answer to, and there are various beautiful things about these contours, the answer to your question is yes. It'll be a little easier to talk about in the context of some concrete example. So let me say that the most zeroth order statement is that there's a correspondence between leading singularities and residues, and it's totally clear why a leading singularity is a residue and a residue is a leading singularity. Okay, so that's clear. Now there's a separate question: why do we put them together in the appropriate way to get the amplitude? Like, why do we combine the different residues in the right way together to get the tree amplitude? If no one had ever told me about locality, no one had ever told me about field theory, why would I string together this particular set of objects in this particular way? Is there something nice? Is there something intrinsic about the contour that selects out tree amplitudes? That is the sort of question that you're asking. The answer is there's a number of sort of properties of them that we can say that are clearly totally intrinsic to this object. But yeah. Definitely not unique. Yes. Yes, of course. Oh, yes, of course. No, of course. No, but it's not a unique choice of contour. Definitely not a unique choice of contour. That's the point. There is no unique choice of contour. We can express the result in many different ways. But if you like, there's a unique homology class. So that's the point. We can deform the contour in many ways while not changing the answer. And there is a unique combination of these objects which is local. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one thing that you could say is a principle. I don't want that to be the principle, because that's like cheating. But it's in any case, whether it's cheating or not, it's true that if you take the things that are rational functions here, for example, which have a chance to be tree amplitudes, and you put them together, there's an absolutely unique way of putting it together so that it's local. No question about it. Now, when you look at what that contour looks like, it has some very nice intrinsic properties just in the Grassmannian. You know, it does something. I mean, but this would take a little longer to explain. But it really has some intrinsically nice properties all by itself. But certainly it's true. I mean, there's no other way of putting them together which cancels all the spurious poles and just leaves you with physical things. Okay. Yes. Through this little linear transformation, so that's the Yeah, that's this little magic. Yeah, we went from the W's to the lambdas and lambda tildes, and then in going from k by k to k minus 2 by k minus 2, this little linear transformation happened, and that linear transformation just converted lambdas and lambda tildes into lambdas and mu's, and furthermore put them together in this whole delta 4 slash 4 to turn into a momentum twister. Right? No. It's the lower part together with this linear transformation, which turns k by k to k minus 2 by k minus 2. Yes? Right. Sure, yes. Does it have a computational advantage? I can say that conceptually, yes. Okay, conceptually, it does have an advantage in the sense that the way this thing packages supersymmetry is particularly nice. And extracting superamplitudes, extracting components out of superamplitudes, is a sort of complete triviality that you can do at the very end of the calculation. But it's the same formula. I mean, it's the same. They are equal, but it is a different packaging of it. Yeah. So it's. None of it's, I think, numerically a particularly big deal. But it's. If you like, this is the implementation that Jake Bergeli made available. So this his BCFW package does things with both ordinary momenta and with momentum twisters this way of organizing, certainly nothing that we then went on to do with Lupin Lagrange or anything, none of it would have been possible without this packaging. I mean, it's just analytically, it's shockingly effective. He has this nice package where you can see the 14-point amplitude analytically if you want, and it's possible to do so quickly because it's being packaged in this way. And also, there's nothing particularly special about that. I mean, it's a very nice solution that they wrote down to the recursion, but that solution is the recursion relation. I mean, it's no more or less than the recursion relation. It's one way of solving the, and then there's 10 ways of solving the recursion relation. So So that's really sort of conceptually what this object is about. You have something. It doesn't care about one space time or the other space time particularly, which is why what it does is spit out invariants under both symmetries. It doesn't care about either one. There's no locality in either space, and so it's just giving you the building blocks that have all the symmetries in them. Okay. Okay. Now it turns out that you can start asking interesting questions like. Given some of these residues, can you do things to them? If I hand you one of them, can you take two of them and build another one? Okay? Are there sort of elementary tinker toy operations on these things that you can do to build new ones out of old ones? And it's all just it all follows in this very elementary way from properties of these little determinants. There's a much nicer sort of geometric way of thinking about it now, but I think. Given the time, let me just say a few things without going through that more geometric picture. So, for instance, given two of them, you can jam them together to build a. So the sort of very basic operations are that you can take one of them and. So if you take one invariant and another invariant, and they don't share any indices in common, if you just multiply them, then it's going to be an invariant of the bigger one. That's sort of totally trivial. If you think about what the matrices look like, it's like making a big, big K by N matrix with a block up here and a block down there. Okay? That's the first operation. Now, the more interesting, now we can do slightly more interesting ones. For example, we can take a particle, we can take one with one more particle, and we can remove that particle. We can remove this particle in two ways. If you're going to remove a particle, either K will decrease or K will stay the same. Okay? So K can stay the same or it can decrease by one. So let's see the two cases. If K is going to stay the same, if this is, let's say, particle N, what I can do is I can take particle N, that's 1, 2, and so on, I can just merge N with 1, or I can merge N with N minus 1. What that means literally is if I take M, let's say it's in these momentum twister variables, although it doesn't matter, it's just a property of these Grassmannian integrals. If I literally take Zn minus 1 and then Zn and I just make Zn equal to Z1, so projectively, if I think of these points as points in this CP3, I just take one point. The only projective meaningful thing I can do with it is to merge it with the next one, right? To remove it. Okay? So that's one thing I can do. That gives me a new invariant. Okay? I can take one of them, and I can remove it by integrating over it. That's something else that I can do. And this reduces K by 1 because that's a supersymmetric integral. So I'm removing four of the Grassmann variables. Okay. So this is the merge and this is the delete. Okay? I can also take one and add a particle. Okay? I can also take the simplest way of adding particle N plus 1. So if here's N plus 1 and 1, I want to add this particle. The simplest thing I can do is to just do nothing. Say that this object is just equal to m of z1 up to zn. So n plus 1 just like a fake extra label. I'm saying that the new residue is equal to just the same one without it. Okay? So this preserves k, but it adds a particle. Then I can add a particle in a way that increases k as well. Okay? So we can add a particle, add n plus 1 here between n and 1. Remember, everything now has a cyclic structure. So all of these things that I'm doing are happening in some cyclic order. So these are some elementary operations that we can do. Yeah. Yes, that's right. So these, for example, these things take soft limits. Yeah. K preserving and K decreasing soft limits. So in components, it would be negative and positive Felicity gluons. Okay? And these things are what we called a number of years ago inverse soft factors. So there are things that you can do to take a lower object and add something to it, such that if you then took the soft limit of the one that you added, you got back to the one that you started with. Okay? So that's it. These are the totally basic operations that you can do that makes new things out of old ones. Of course, you don't have to. I mean, you could just start with the whole big residue and just compute things. But this is just telling you how you could build up the more complicated ones from these elementary operations. For example, BCFW. If you take two terms and you want to jam them together to make to give you the way those two things would occur in the BCFW formula. That's just a combination of these simple things, okay? In the obvious way. Put this here, that there, you first put them side by side, you merge this intermediate one, you integrate over it, that's it, okay? And that works in momentum, in twister space, in momentum twister space. They're not exactly the same operations in one or the other, but it's always just some simple combination of these basic operations give you the BCFW jamming together. So, in other words, that's what makes it totally obvious without any work that BCFW is Yangian invariant. You don't have to check anything. It's just built out of Yangian invariants using these elementary operations on the invariants that map invariants to invariants. Okay? So the interesting thing is where loops come from. So loop integrals come from the following process. So imagine you have a particle A and a particle B. Here's N and 1. And let's say I want to remove particle A, and then I remove particle B. So that's some ZA and ZB. Now, if I remove particle A, it's one of them, nothing much interesting happens. I go from, now, that's, again, a contour integral, and there are many residues that I could pick, so there isn't a unique place that I can land even. Okay? The claim is no matter where I go to, from an invariant to an invariant. Okay? But nothing very interesting happens. All I can, the only way I can do that integral is on little circles to take these contours, and that's it. Now, let's say I remove two particles, one after the other. Then, if I do it one at a time, there's also nothing interesting that I can do. I first remove one, then I remove the other, and all I get, if I say I start from some tree amplitude upstairs, I get some tree amplitude downstairs. Nothing new. However, when there's pairs of them like this, there's another contour of integration that I can choose, which is that I can take, here's A and B, these are points in these are now points in CP3, so here's A and B. So I'm thinking about this in momentum twister space. And I can first integrate A and B along the line that they define. And after I've done that integral, I can do the integral over all lines. So that's just it. So instead of doing one and then the other, I'm going to do this entangled contour of integration. It's entangled for obvious reasons. So the way you're integrating A and B are entangled in this specific way. Okay. So we first do this integral. That then removes the dependence on A and B specifically and only leaves the dependence on the line AB. Then I do the integral of the line AB. So really, this is a six-dimensional integral. And all I'm saying is I'm doing two of the integrals on residues. And the remaining integral I'm now going to think about as doing as an integral over, let's say, the real slice of Minkowski space and interpret as a loop integral. Because remember, loop integrals are integrals over lines in momentum twister space. Okay? So this is where things like loop integrals come from. They start with objects, and you remove two of them. And if you just remove them in a boring way, you don't get any loop integral. But if you remove them in this entangled way, you get a loop integral. So we denote that entangled removal by that little picture. Okay. Once again, this is guaranteed to be Yangian invariant. Now, what do I mean by this? Now, it's got this bosonic loop integration variable, right? What I mean by it is it's guaranteed to be Yangian invariant because the form that it started with is invariant. And so any symmetry transformation that I do is going to turn into a total derivative with respect to the integration variables. So that's really the point. The form is an invariant form, and then I'm integrating it. So the integrand is Yangian invariant, which means that under the symmetry generators, it transforms into a total derivative. Okay, so those are the basic ingredients. And so now I can at least finally explain the BCFW all-loop recursion in this language. Okay, so having gone over all this stuff, I stress again that the BCFW, that this all-loop recursion is not special to n equals 4. It's probably true in any supersymmetric theory, certainly in n equals 2 supersymmetric theories, probably in n equals 1 theories, at least the two loops. And so it's not special to Yangian invariants or n equals 4 or anything. In principle, I didn't have to tell you any of this in order to write down this all-loop recursion. In practice, to actually compute with it, like I said, this sort of the Grassmannian technology is very, very powerful for actual computations, first of all. The sort of essential loop level object, this single cut that I'm going to talk about in a second, dealing with it in this language is vastly, vastly easier than dealing with it directly. Because you think of it as a contour integral in the way you think about everything else. And anyway, it's very uniform the way it's treated. But in principle, I didn't have to say any of it, and it could just stand alone by itself. just like in principle, you don't need to know for tree-level BCFW that it happens to be dual conformal invariant. If you just want the answer, it's the answer, right? But it's some remarkable property of the answer that is, it's nice to understand. So I'm going to present the answer for the all-loop recursion in a way that's a sum of two terms, the usual BCFW term and the sort of seed loop for the loops, and they're just both presented in terms of these Tinker-Toy operations jamming together invariants. So it's just completely manifest that this thing is Yang invariant. Okay? But all right. So what's the idea? So the idea is that we do the BCFW deformation on two adjacent legs. Okay, let's say I want to do the BCFW deformation on one and two. Very nicely, this is a nice little momentum twister exercise for you. That the standard BCFW deformation corresponds to a deformation in momentum twister space of Zn goes to Zn plus little z Zn minus one. Okay. So it's a nice exercise in drawing what those polygons look like to see that this deformation on the momentum twister variables affects the BCFW transformation on the lambdas and the lambda tildes. Okay. But it's just this beautiful shift. And that's why BCFW terms are dual conformal invariant, because the transformation looks beautiful in twister space, in momentum twister space. By the way, it looks exactly the same in twister space. So that's one of the reasons why each term is Yangian invariant all by itself. Okay. But anyway, so this is really the shift that we are doing, and so we're really after the MNK that depends, let's say, at one loop on the line AB. This is the loop line and all the external data, so all the other Zs. At two loops, it would be, you know, some AB and CD and the ZA and so on. Okay, so it just depends on these lines and the rest of the points. That's literally the object, that rational function, right? So I'm going to write down a formula for that rational function. Okay, so the point is that under this shift, what kind of poles can we encounter? Okay. Well, one set of poles are obvious. One set of poles that I can have in the integrand, in the finite diagrams, is totally obvious. The usual ones, where you have n particles on one side, the other ones on the other side, just the usual BCFW ones. Okay? And those things give us things that look like, it's just that now, if we have L1 loops over here, it can get split between having L1 loops over here and L2 loops over there, where L1 plus L2 is equal to the loop order we're interested in. Okay. So this is not touching any of the internal loop integration variables. It's just the standard factorization. Okay. That's one set of terms. But the other set of terms are more interesting. The other set of terms are when So as I'm deforming one and two, the other set of terms are where under the deformation I put the line, just the internal line that's just running from one to two, on shell. So that's a single cut. That's the only other kind of pole that I can have. I can't have a pole that's sort of deep inside the Feynman diagram somewhere, right? It's because of the planar structure. I have one here, and the only pole that I pick up is a single cut of the one lower point amplitude, one lower loop amplitude. Okay. So the other sorts of poles are where, as I deform one and two, the intermediate line in the loop diagram can go on shell. Yes, because of summing Feynman diagrams. Well, right. Oh, no. So at the moment, I'm just thinking about the standard Feynman diagrams. Forget about the Grassmannian for a second. Forget it. Yeah, I'm just talking about what the terms look like, right? Like I said, this part of the argument we could just say without ever talking about the Grassmannian or anything like that, right? I'm just generalizing BCFW beyond trees to loops. And there's two non-trivial points. One of them is that the integrand exists, so we can talk about something. We can talk about a rational function to go after. And the other one is that this single cut exists. Okay? So the other kind of pole that I can have is where this is where I have a single cut between. So I have a single cut in this picture between n and 1, and then there's something here, right? And then I have the sort of one lower point loop amplitude in there, right? Yeah, we're not even talking, again, we're not even talking about the Grassmannian at the moment. What I'm doing is first saying what they look like in field theory, and then I'm going to tell you what that object is as a residue in the Grassmannian, precisely. That's really the point. Now, these single cuts are notoriously funny objects because they're naively not well behaved. So, of course, let me take it back. The single cut of an amplitude, the single cut is manifestly well defined. If you have the integrand, you do the deformation, there's a pole there, and you can pick it up. The question is, can we compute the single cut from on-shell data? And the difficulties begin because you can have diagrams with zero. I mean that if you wanted to think of it as the naively what this is momentum k and negative k. So it looks like the forward limit of a tree amplitude. Okay. But if you're going to sum forward limits of tree amplitudes, it would naively include terms in the tree amplitude that looks like that and that and that, which would develop a singularity, and that's something that would be a tadpole in the loop diagram that isn't even there. Right? So that makes an obstruction in general between identifying the single cut with the forward limit of a tree amplitude. There's two obstructions. One, the forward limit of the tree amplitude is ill-defined. Two, what makes it ill-defined is exactly what adds pieces to it that are not there in the single cut. Okay? That's the issue. However, beautifully, in n equals 4 superyang nulls, these diagrams, when you sum over all the helicities, vanish. And the single cut is well-defined. Sorry, the forward limit of the tree amplitude is well-defined. And therefore, it's equal to the single cut. Right? So that's a special thing about n equals 4, which is also true for n equals 2 and also true for n equals 1, at least to a two loops. Right. Yes, exactly. It's very related to that. Yes, it's very, very related to that fact, indeed. Okay? So that means that in n equals 2 and n equals 1, probably, certainly to two loops, maybe to higher, you can run this argument. All we need are the single cuts. The forward limits of the tree amplitudes are equal to the single cuts. So that's the other kind of term you have in the recursion. So we have this term, plus you have what looks like the sort of plus these single cuts. Okay. So here's n and 1. These are the two guys that we cut. Okay. And this is l minus 1. Okay. Now comes what I was mentioning is that just even computing these forward limits. If you take the tree amplitude and just compute the forward limit by taking the limit and stuff like that, it's a little bit delicate. You get the right answer, but it is a little bit delicate. However, this object is manifestly built by jamming Grassmannian residues together, and this forward limit has a beautiful interpretation on Grassmannian residues. It's literally what I told you. It's literally integrating out two particles in this entangled way. So you have this, and you have something that looks like you have A and B. Actually, in detail, what enforces what you know in BCFW, you have the hadded variables, and you have to evaluate things in the hadded locations, and all of that stuff. All of that is taken care of by the following sequence of operations. So you imagine taking the residue for 1, A, B, N. Sorry, let's write it as N. 1, 2, sorry, I keep up to n. Let me put the n here. The first thing you do is you add a particle, let's call it n plus 1 for a second. Then you remove A and B in the entangled way. And then you merge n plus 1 with 1. So that combination of operations on Yangian invariants is what taking the forward limit of the amplitude at the BCFW required location turns out to be. Sorry? Oh, I mean, I'm just telling you, this would take a little longer to explain. I mean, what because if you just start with, if you start with the residue as is, it's not a value at some shifted location, right? So it turns out that that process of adding the particle and merging and everything does exactly what you need to the geometry to take it to the shifted location, evaluate the single cut there, and everything. That, I mean, that would take maybe another hour to explain how all these things work. But I just want to point out that was sort of both this piece and this piece is the same thing. I told you, like, take this, you jam it with that, you integrate over that guy. It's all these basic tinker toy operations for putting things together for that one, and you just remove these particles in this entangled way to give you the forward limit terms. Okay. Sorry? Yes, yes. Well, yeah, the whole thing is published. Yes. This is from our paper last August. So this is the formula for the higher point amplitude at L loops in terms of pieces at lower loops with BCFW jammed together and something that takes the forward limit of the L minus 1 particle amplitude but with two extra particles. Okay? You see, you need this, otherwise all the loop amplitudes would vanish, right? You need a source term because BCFW takes all the trees down to three-point functions, and if all we had was this, we'd take the loops down to the three-point loops, which vanish, right? So you need a source, and the source are these single cuts. Okay? So that basic fact is true in any theory where the forward limit is well-defined and computes the single cuts, which is probably most supersymmetric theories. But this particular fact that we can interpret every single one of these operations as an operation on these elementary operations on these Grassmannian residues is what proves that this object is Yangian invariant. Okay. This is still the integrand. Yes, this is still on the integrand. And so, but like I said, this is now and manipulating all of these things is, I mean. This is perhaps not obvious, but the reason why the sort of formalism is so powerful and we can do it on our laptops is because we never touch actual lambdas and lambda tildes. Nothing. All we ever do is linear algebra. All we ever do is manipulate these K by N matrices. You manipulate the K by N matrices, and at the very end of the day, you solve on the support of those delta functions to tell you what the K by N matrices are in terms of the external data. So this is something I haven't had a chance to describe. But all of the action, all of the geometry, everything is going on inside the Grassmannian. You never talk about functions of the actual momenta or anything like that. You talk about configurations of points in this projective space. And sometimes they look more special. Sometimes this is collinear with that. But that's what labels the object is what kind of relationship these points have with each other. You then want to actually compute it. Yeah, you tack on the delta function, and it just tells you how to get numbers out of it. But all of the action, all the relationships between these guys, all of the geometry is purely happening inside the Grassmannian, and that's what makes it easy to do this computation. So that's what I was saying. If you literally want to take all these limits, or even do the BCFW bridge, or anything directly in terms of the momenta, well, it's a little bit more work than just playing cutting and pasting matrices, which is all we do. In practice, okay? You cut and paste matrices until the very end of the calculation, where you plug in on the support of the delta functions and get the answer. It's just completely manifest that all the action is happening in there, and we get a window into it from the only way it interacts with the external world is through these delta functions. Let me also say that I should have mentioned. That this fact that the forward limit for n equals 4 is well defined was not obvious and was in this paper of Simon Caron-Huo, one of like four spectacular papers this guy's written in the past year and a half. But this is just a fantastic fact that that is absolutely critical for this to make sense. So, now he was doing it in the context of the Feynman tree theorem and trying to play with the Feynman tree theorem. So, I mean, it's very nice there as well, but the Feynman tree theorem gets complicated beyond one loop. But the sort of natural home for this observation is that you can then use it to just trivialize BCFW and do it to all loops. So that's, but then, of course, it's then also very nice that these single cuts and everything have this beautiful tinker toy operation interpretation in the Grassmannian. But again, I want to stress that, I stress it because it might really be worth developing in lower supersymmetric theories to see if there's, to start getting some data about what the integrands look like there. I should also say that, so another big piece of progress in the past 6-8 months has been figuring out this duality between Wilson loops and scattering amplitude that Johannes was talking about earlier today. That duality, as originally proposed, was for MHV amplitudes. I mean, it's an amazing conjecture that Wilson loops should be related to scattering amplitudes. But it was originally for MHV amplitudes. In other words, there was no helicity information in the Wilson loop. It wasn't clear if you wanted to compute something that isn't an MHV amplitude where all the helicity information goes. Well, in the past 8 months, the Wilson loop has found a supersymmetric generalization, a natural supersymmetric generalization. It's really most naturally written in momentum twister space, again. It's literally a Wilson loop in momentum twister space. It also has a space-time way of, there's also a space-time way of writing it, which involves sort of spreading fermions along the edges in some very, very pretty way. And this duality between the Wilson loop and the amplitude has been proven. How has it been proven? You take the Wilson loop, and you prove that the Wilson loop satisfies the same BCFW recursion relation, exactly the same recursion relation. Okay? In fact, that proof is extremely pretty in the twister space, because in the twister space, it's literally, like I said, it's literally this a Wilson loop that lives along these lines, these big null lines that I these big lines in that polygon in a twister space, not the space-time polygon, but the twister space polygon. As you deform this polygon, you find that it has singularities when it self-intersects appropriately, and that the residues on those singularities are exactly, precisely this funny operation with the remove and add and all of that stuff precisely comes out of that. And it's literally some sort of holomorphic analog of what are known as the Skein relations in computing not polynomials for more complicated knots in terms of simpler ones. So there are well-known recursion relations for computing complicated knot polynomials in terms of simpler ones. And some holomorphic analog of that is exactly BCFW, except for the Wilson loop. Okay? And so you see that the Wilson loop satisfies exactly the same recursion relation as the amplitude. That's how you know that they're the same thing. At the level of the integrand, they're identical. Okay? And so that's the sort of the remarkable point, is that there are two objects in the world with precisely the same singularity structures. One of them is an amplitude, and the other one's a super Wilson loop. Okay, so that's proven. So I think there is still some real magic that needs to be understood, even at the level of the integrand, even at tree level already. Which has to do with the fact that the answers, as I mentioned, the answers are expressed and can still be expressed in many different ways. And we even have some understanding, again, purely intrinsically within this world, we have some understanding for why, for the sort of identities that tell you that all these different ways of writing the answer are the same, that the spurious poles cancel, all of that stuff. These are all ultimately contour deformation arguments in the Grassmannian, or when you think about them more geometrically, sort of simple, more geometrically, all of these residues are actually associated with some big polytope that lives in the Agrostomonia. And all the relations between them are associated with going to, they're actually associated with faces of some polytope in the Agrostomonia. And if you want to know all the relations, you go to one higher dimensional faces, and you look at all the things in the boundary of these one higher dimensional face, and you add them all up, and they're equal to zero. That's all the relations. So I don't have time to explain it, but there's some rich geometry that's controlling this. But something that's surprising is that we found sort of experimentally that there seems to be yet another way of even writing tree amplitudes, still good old-fashioned tree amplitudes, seem to be able to be expressed in a way that doesn't look like BCFW, that isn't manifestly unitary like BCFW, but is manifestly local. Even for NMHV amplitudes, we found another formula for NMHV amplitudes, which isn't BCFW, is manifestly local, and in fact, it comes from this picture that we have all these different ways of putting these residues together to make some object that doesn't depend. There are many different ways of expressing the same thing. We understand the sort of identities that tell you they're all the same thing as sort of residue theorems, so there's some nice geometry. But in some simple cases, we can really go further than that. There's a real geometric picture of what it is that you're computing. And as I mentioned, it's the volume of something. And in some cases, it's literally the volume of some polytope in a projective space. Literally some nice polytope. And when you triangulate it one way, you get BCFW. But then when you see the picture, you see another way of triangulating it. And this other way of triangulating it is manifestly local. Not manifestly unitary, manifestly local. For NMHV amplitudes at 6 points, it turns out to reproduce the Behrens and Thiele formula that they had found for 6 points long ago. And beyond 6 points, of course, it's beyond 6 points, it's just as compact as BCFW, essentially. Okay, but it looks totally different. So another hint that there's something going on were those formulas I wrote down for the multi-loop integrants. Those were local integrants, and incredibly simple. How do we get those formulas? Well, we derived them from the recursion relations, which is why we know they're true. And originally, they arose because we were trying to check that, in fact, what we got from the recursion relation was right. It didn't have spurious poles. So we tried to expand in a nice-looking basis, and we found that they could be expressed in those amazingly simple ways, even simpler than what you get from BCFW recursion. So either it's an accident that low loop orders and things start getting horribly complicated starting at 4 or 5 loops, which I very much doubt, or there's some picture which is telling you where these local things come from. And so that's, I think, a totally open problem. In other words, this entire story is very tailored towards understanding the singularity structure. It's sort of very close to unitarity. It's tailored to understanding the singularity structure, but there might be some dual picture to it that's much more tailored towards locality and doesn't care so much about unitarity. But at least in these simple cases we understand, it's really, it's at least to me, marvelous to see that there's something that doesn't care about either one, but which you can make locality and unitarity manifest in two different presentations of the same object. I strongly suspect it has a generalization that tells us directly where these other formulas come from. But I must say, we've struggled for 6 months to find a picture, even for n-squared MHV tree amplitudes. I mean, not anything fancy. Yeah. And perhaps that's the final comment I will make, is the whole notion of what's simple and complicated in this story is really different than what you would naively think. You would naively think that simplicity and complexity is a sort of a graph that looks like going to more particles and more loops, and things get harder in both directions, right? But that's not really what it's like in n equals 4. In n equals 4, it looks like the number of particles is irrelevant. It's k, and in fact, in some sense, n equals infinity is the simplest of all, because you actually get misled at low numbers of particles. You don't see the generic situation yet, so you have to go to a large number of particles to see what the really generic situation is. So n infinity is the best, but it's really k and l, and in fact, simplicity is along this direction, like NMHV tree. So k equals 1, l equals 0, and MHV one loop are the same thing. are as complicated, but they're controlled by basically the same object. It's particularly obvious from the recursion relation, because you start from the NMHV tree, and its forward limits give you the MHV1 loop. So similarly, N squared MHV tree, NMHV1 loop, MHV2 loop are the same thing. In fact, the hardest part is the N squared MHV tree, and you lose information in going to the loop, one loop, and you lose a little more information going to the two loops. So some really new presentation of N squared MHV tree, I think the reason we've been struggling so much is that there's some real idea needed to see it, but it's probably going to teach us a lot. And so, but anyway, this is the direction. This is the axis of hard. I mean, so hard is in this direction. So that's another interesting qualitative insight. And the final thing is that most of what people have been thinking about, well, not most of, a lot of what people have been thinking about in the past 5-6 months or so, well, really starting from this wonderful paper of Christian and Mark and Nastya and Sasha Goncharov from about a year ago, is how to actually do the integrals. And it's wonderful. It's great to have the integrand, but you still would like to know how to do the integral and get the actual answers. And we know that the actual answers are, in the end of the day, after we strip off various relatively simple to control infrared pieces, are dye logarithms at one loop, polylogarithms at two loops and higher. Li2s, Li4s, more complicated, much more complicated polylogs at the two loops and higher. And and sort of famously, there was this heroic calculation of the 6-point remainder function at two loops that was expressed in terms of 17 pages of complicated polylogarithms that Mark and Nasi and Christian and Sasha Goncharov, who's the sort of world expert on the theory of polylogs, simplified to one line. Okay. Now, why did this happen? It's because polylogs satisfy lots of crazy identities. You can write them in this way, you can write them in that way. And where have we heard that story before? Right? That this is a very common feature in this story, that you have some object and there's many, many representatives of it. But what it is itself has some. There is characterized by some homology class that you need to understand, and this is more than a vague analogy, because Goncharov's theory for understanding where these things come from turns out to be incredibly well. So he has a theory for the so-called symbol of all of these polylogs, which the non-LHC people here will, if there are any, people have heard a lot about. But something that's maybe not so commonly known is that this theory of the symbol of polylogarithmic objects, which is supposed to control all these identities, is massively recursive. In fact, these symbols satisfy recursion relations that look identical to BCFW. And it's not surprising. It's not surprising because these symbols are, in the end, about telling you about the discontinuities of the functions. So it should be that there should be a sort of a direct way from going from these pictures of the integrand that make the discontinuities manifest directly to a picture of the symbol, which is supposed to make the discontinuities manifest. And to add to the mix of optimism in this direction, his nicest definition of the most general class of polylogs are integrals over the Grassmannian, as it turns out, with exactly the measure that we're talking about here. So this measure that I motivated in this way, the measure of minors. This measure with minors, as I mentioned, turns out to be, well, I had no time to tell you about this part of the Grassmannian, this so-called positive part of the Grassmannian, which is where all of this is actually coming from. But there's, no, in fact, this is actually the point. There's a natural part of the Grassmannian. It's all about trying to find some nice notion of an inside of a space. So if you have a projective space, like a plane, you can draw three lines, and you can say that you want to be inside. You want to be inside that triangle. Okay? There's actually, because it's projective, there's many triangles. There's this triangle that goes out to infinity and comes back. There's that triangle. There's sort of four triangles here. There's four different notions of inside. But still, there's some notion of inside. And then the closure of this notion of inside is a nice simplex. It's the triangle. And you can go to higher dimensions, projective spaces, it's just a simplex. So simplex is a nice thing, but it's not very deep. However, it turns out that if you ask the generalization of this question in a Grassmannian, it's exactly the same question. So literally, you want to talk, let's say, in G2, n, we want to look at configurations of two-dimensional vectors in an n-dimensional space, right? Sorry, so take n two-dimensional vectors, and now I want to define the notion of an inside. So here, the notion of an inside, I could have also gotten by picking some coordinates and saying that x2 and x3 are positive. Okay. So the notion of inside is the same as the notion of positivity. You say there's some positive part of the space, which then naturally has boundaries, where some of those coordinates go to zero. So you try to do the similar thing. You try to find the positive part of G2n. So what you do is write something like this down, and then let's say demand that all the minors are positive. So ij is positive for I less than j, let's say. Okay? It's the only thing you could do, the only natural notion of positivity that you can have. Here, going to the boundary of the space was trivial. You just put x2 to 0 or x3 to 0. But here, going to the boundary turns out to be much more intricate, because these are nonlinear relations. So for example, I can't put the minor 1, 3 to 0 without putting the minor 1, 2, and 2, 2, 3 to 0 first. And so nowhere in this question have I put anything about cyclicity, nowhere have I put anything about consecutive minors, but it turns out that what characterizes the space has everything to do with consecutive minors and cyclic structure. A cyclic structure and consecutivity are an output. Okay? And then this space has a closure, which is a polytope. In this case, it's a simplex. But here it was a simplex. In the Grassmannian, it's a much more intricate polytope. And then you can ask the question, is there a measure that you can put on this positive part of the space, which is non-singular? That's all. A nice non-singular measure on this positive part of the space. And the answer is that there's a unique measure, which is non-singular on the positive part of the space, which is the one that we wrote down. And so all the residues are literally the faces of this polytope. So when we compute residues of this integral, we're just going to the faces, and then faces of the faces, edges, you know, some codimension face of this polytope. So all the leading singularities of n equals 4 are associated with certain faces of this polytope. And that's the way you think about them. I mean, in fact, you totally stop thinking about them, like I said, as functions of momenta. You just draw, you know, where you are in this polytope, and that tells you the leading singularity you're looking at. Yeah. So yeah. Oh yes. Sorry. Yes. That's right. The surfaces are so. In fact, so. Yes. So first of all, Gontcharov polylogs are like a basis for all these polylogs. But the very natural way of defining them is as integrals. So normal polylogs, simple poly, like a dialogue, is really an integral. It's like a dx over x, dy over y over some triangle. So what you want to do is do an integral which is d log something over a nice little closed region. If you generalize that for any projective space, so you integrate something with n poles over some simplex, you get a nice big set of polylogs. They're called the Aomoto polylogs. They're a nice big set of polylogs, but they're not all polylogs. They're a subset of the Gontcharov polylogs. And that's why Gontcharov started to wonder, how might you define, you see, if you just define random polylogs, then you have to hunt around for the identities they satisfy. It's like a pain to sort of really understand what all the structure is. Whereas this way of defining, even this way of defining a dialogue, is dx over x, dy over y over some triangle, makes something obvious. Like if you take this triangle and that triangle and put them together to make a square, then I can chop that square up and huh? If I make it some jagged square, it's not a log square. But if I chop it up this way and that way, I get the same results if I chop it up that way and that way. Okay, so this shows that this way of talking about dialogarithmic things satisfies some four-term identity. Okay, that plus that equals that plus that. That four-term identity is the fundamental identity that generates all the other identities about dialogues, including a classic five-term dialogue identity, is actually this four-term identity in disguise. So all of them are just, so the claim is that all the identities that these amodal polylogs satisfy are just are arrived at by chopping up the simplex in different ways. Okay? No, that's right, and exactly. And so I think that was a motivation to hunt around and find some bigger space that you could integrate, some bigger inside that you could integrate over some form with singularities to get polylogs. So that's why it was natural for him to look for the notion of an inside, not in the projective space, but in the one generalization up from the projective space, which is de Grassmannian. Right. He's still right. I mean, he was still, as of a year ago, writing papers about it. But he had, in fact, you know, literally within two. It is very much an open question. But in fact, I think that the sort of really exciting thing from the point of view of the mathematicians, I hope, and I think, is that this whole way of thinking about polylogs is integrals with the boundaries given over some simplex over something, over some region, of some form over some simplex, is probably not the most natural way of thinking about what polylogs are, because it has these two ingredients, the sort of boundary and the sort of singularities of the form that you're integrating. Quantum field theory, loop integrals don't look like that. Loop integrals don't have any boundary. We integrate over all of space-time, right? So, but we have singular surfaces, and from this language, you see. So in the standard way of writing things, it's not so obvious. But in the form that comes out of these recursion relations, this is what I was mentioning. The integrand comes out in the form that looks like d d d d. You know, it's like the wedge of several d's together. It looks like a massive total derivative. As I said a number of times, and it's only equal to not equal to zero because it finds these boundaries, and the boundaries are being put in there by the reality conditions that are telling you that you're integrating over Minkowski space. So this looks like a much more natural way of defining polylogs. You don't have this artificial distinction between boundaries and forms. But the price is that you have an integral with twice as many integration variables, but those twice as many integration variables are sort of looking for a natural boundary. Oh, I totally agree. No, I totally agree. But I'm just, so my statement is really a moral one, that sort of at the level of the integrand, there's now a presentation, which is the BCFW presentation is just, this is the form that makes the singularities as obvious as they can possibly be, right? That's how they're built. And now, the symbol of a polylogarithmic object is supposed to be something that's a list of all of its singularities. So if one of these things isn't built for the other, there's no justice in the world. So it must be that you can go from one to the other in some way. But the heart of the matter and what's difficult about it is we have to learn how to do really a new set of integrals, a new kind of integrals in a new way, which focus on these sort of singular structures with the, you see, you don't run into any of this when we do integrals the usual way, because the first thing we do is we finally parametrize. Then we do the loop integral and it's gone. Right? The loop integral is gone at the first step. Then we're left with the Feynman parameter. Now, Feynman parameter integrals are now looking like an integral over a simplex. You know, it starts looking much more standard. But that's also why you see, when you actually try to extract the symbol out of Feynman parameter integrals, it's a lot of work. And actually, the sort of process of doing it, which we've learned how to do at one loop, at two loops, and so on, makes it start looking like you're back reconstructing a sort of a BCFW-like decomposition of the object. For example, you start with something which almost has physical singularities, but as you try to compute its symbol in some systematic way, you find yourself forced to be including spurious things in the middle. It feels like because we know one way of doing these integrals, which is to Feynman parametrize, there's sort of one integral we know how to do. We do that, but it forces us to go this very roundabout way that's hiding the sort of essential thing, which is the singularity structure. And so, anyway, but that's, this is something I've been working on off and on for the last 5 or 6 months. There's some progress, but I think, anyway, it's a sort of a prediction. It's a hope that I think this is the essential issue, and when it gets sorted out, there will be sort of at the level that there will be these things, and there will be just some sort of symbol transcription of them just instantly without any work, or with some sort of minimal work. At any rate, I hope it's clear that it's all amazingly sort of combinatorial, algebraic, geometric. You know, you're just playing around with you're playing around with a lot of sort of linear algebra, and somehow the actual functions at the end are some very derivative thing at the very very end of the day. That I find just extremely interesting. And so this is sort of what I was referring to in the very first lecture, that it's one of the great things about BCFW, even at tree level, is that it was a sort of halfway point, because you can derive it from field theory, so you know for sure that it's right, but somehow it has a flavor and a smell of something that comes from somewhere else. And now we see very explicitly, they really come from somewhere else as well anyway. They're associated with faces of this polytope in the Grassmannian, and all the relations and everything between them, together with their all-loop friends, are just things that live in this wonderful space. But I think I've gone on way too long already, so thanks a lot.